On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Evening edition. It is Thursday, isn't it? Yes, it is. Shockingly so, I might add. It is Thursday. And so far, so good. Lots and lots and lots of snow, but no untoward effects. I have deliberately made myself today an explorer of the great indoors. I don't like that crap anymore. Past December 25th, all snowflakes falling after December 25th. Are a nuisance. Really? But, you know, we may get a little warm spell and lose some of it, but I think it kicks up again over the weekend. Fat. Blech. Snow, go away, don't come again some other day. Yes, I know, I sound positively benighted in saying that, but, just too old for this. I will soon turn a creaky, crotchety 48 years old. I thought this evening, because I got another one of those Jim Dandy emails from our buddy Scott in Sweden. I thought we would let Scott start the program for us. You know, when you guys pour heart and soul into five or six paragraphs, those are five or six paragraphs that I feel compelled to read. And so we will go to that in just a matter of a second or two. Good news! Here on this Thursday, and after this show, we will have only two more January shows left. But here on this Thursday, I can tell you that we are only $190 away from making our fundraising goal for January. We need 19 members of the Thrifty 250, or some combination thereof. Just this evening, we had an individual, who knows who he is, step up and take 5 slots in the Nifty 250, bringing us down to $190 to get where it is we are going. And that's magnificent. So, if you can fill those slots this evening, it would be great. And then tomorrow night nor Monday night do I have to say a word about fundraising or contributions. Devoutly to be wished. Because among other things, it just feels like a good omen. First of all, we had the generous gifting to Tribe Kincaid of the first vacation we have had in 12 years. And that got the year off to a rollicking, rousing start. And every day that gets a little closer to us heading for the Caribbean is a little bit more that got 2011 off to a good start in just a close personal way. And frankly, meeting our fundraising goal and starting 2011 without being in the red would be double bonus on top of that. The PayPal button, as you know, is at headonradionetwork.com under the tab Contribute, as is the snail mail address, if you prefer to go that way. And at some point in the near future, we're going to be adding Google Checkout for those of you who don't like PayPal. And hopefully that will make things perhaps more palatable as well. So there you have it in a nutshell. But I did, as I said, we're gonna let Scott in Sweden start the program out tonight, because it might provide a little bit of fodder for further consideration and conversation. I actually had this yesterday, but I didn't get to it, and it's just as well, because there's stuff in there that continues to work this evening. Hi, Bob, says Scott, writing from Sweden. There are times when I really wish I could call in instead of reacting to the podcast a day or two later. Your conversations with Sandra are inevitably babushka dolls, with me being the innermost babushka. One of the outer babushkas in this case is my college subscription to the New Republic, reading Charles Krauthammer. You might recall there was a discussion of that a couple of nights ago. And letting that subscription lapse. I'd be interested to know how many other of my fellow hornies share that experience with us. It is hard to avoid the issue of race in America, and I have a suspicion that, like your summer of laying sod, a great number of white liberals got a boost toward liberal awareness by butting up against white racism against a friend. One such prod came in college when the luck of the draw placed me in the same room with a black student from Cleveland. Darnell and I got along very well after a little initial hesitation, primarily on my part, because I came from white rural farmland. What woke me up was an incessant nitpicking from about 10% of the white students in the corridor who had a morbid fascination with Darnell and wanted any dirt I could deliver. I refused, mainly because Darnell might have been the best pure student in that dorm. I never met anyone who worked more diligently to master a subject, in this case applied medical technology. But even if Darnell had been a slacker like everyone else, he was still a very nice guy. This diehard racism just became an increasingly nasty, probably became because Darnell was going to make it in life, and these racists apparently felt any and all the good jobs out there should be reserved for white folks. First, they tried to talk me into their worldview by telling me what those people were really like, and when I told them to just lay off, rumors began to emerge on the corridor that we were gay lovers. I was doing his homework. Yada, yada, yada. Not only were they unfair to Darnell, but they would tear down anyone who would not sign on to the BS. That little insight gave me an interpretive key to a lot of what was going on just under the surface everywhere. Seeing institutionalized injustice is the start of a good BS filter. Write that one down. Seeing institutionalized injustice is the start of a good BS filter. One begins to ask, how much of received wisdom about anything is really self-serving to the status quo? The times being the tail end of the Vietnam War, there was a superabundance of clues that even I could not miss. I talked to a lot of returning soldiers who had a strong alternative explanation that conflicted with society's basic storyline. Fast forward to Ronald Reagan and Morning in America. Yet another Sandra Bob Babushka doll with me holding a few dolls, hiding a few dolls down. If you have to, just Google it, look it up. I know they're also called nesting dolls, one inside of another, inside of another, inside of another. Just another Sandra Bob Babushka doll with me hiding a few dolls down. I too remember how heavily Reagan et al. Ladled on the bullshit imagery. The reality of the late 1970s was of an America just beginning to come to grips with a wasteful imperialistic war, environmental degradation, natural resource shortages, social injustice ad nauseam. We were at a cusp, a wake-up moment. Parenthetically, I'll add, might it have been a Sputnik moment? We could grow up, take a look at the progress being made in social democratic Europe, where real efforts were being made to improve the lives at the bottom of the economic food chain, but to do so required more maturity than most Americans seemed capable of. Reagan's wake-up call, Morning in America, Morning in America, was anything but. It was a call to return to dreamland, to a mythical land that never was. I will add parenthetically that there is no getting around the fact that Reagan's Morning in America was a straw straight into the laudanum bottle for most of America. Everything's fine, nothing to see here, move along, citizen. 2 years, says Scott, into Ronald Reagan's regime, it was very clear where it was all heading. Watt, Nofziger, Deaver, Poindexter, Secord, Abrams, McFarland, North, and scores more later convicted of selling out the public good for the benefit of a private privileged few. I met a Swedish woman, says Scott, at the time, doing a postdoc in that liberal oasis, Lawrence, Kansas. We met at a little, and I do mean little, group called Latin American Solidarity, which was trying to spread awareness of what was going on in Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador. But only older graduate students and professors supported us. 2 years into Ronald Reagan, the young Republicans were already pursuing their infamous smash-mouth, in-your-face confrontation. There was no debate. There was only orthodoxy. It seemed this new generation reveled in this pseudo-American revivalism. Our message was always labeled PC, as if that were the ultimate trump card and a, to mix game metaphors, get-out-of-discussion-free card. Brigitte was firm. She was heading home. She clearly saw where this was heading and wanted nothing of it. Like Sandra, I left America to skip the rest of the Reagan Revolution. Unlike Sandra, I stayed away. Brigitte was right. America barreled full speed ahead into the Gilded Age past, draping it with red, white, and blue Potemkin bunting. Not to fool the Tsarina, she always knew, but to fool the villagers. Brigitte and I are still together, and our two children, now at prime military age, are safely out of those clutches. Better yet, their minds are free from Ron and Rand Paul, Christian evangelicals, etc. I'm not saying that it is impossible for American youth to have a holistic worldview, witness our buddy Cassie and others. But growing up outside of the U.S. may facilitate it, and I'm very glad that my children grew up here and not in the U.S. So thank you, Bob and Sandra, for discussing our commonalities, our babushka dolls. I'm willing to bet that this is much of what makes we hornies a community. Love to all. Scott, in Sweden. It's like time travel to sit back and think about those days. When I mentioned the other night talking to Sandra my adventures with the CETA program, it bubbled up from somewhere in my memory that I hadn't thought about the CETA program in 30 years. Okay, 28, 27. It was gone. It was out of the forefront of it, except for the fact that going around parks and picking up trash and working on that sod laying crew and getting burnt to a plum frazzle also coincided with something else that summer, and that was the beginnings of an urge to write coherently as opposed to angst-driven pseudo-ballads to, well, you know how that goes. But more than anything else, I got to hang out with people I never would have hung out with otherwise, and I got to see a way of, I got to look at America, and frankly, my little corner of Alabama, in a way I never would have looked at it. And it was as sobering as an ice-cold slap in the face. Because eventually, like I said, the overseers on that project became colorblind. And they hated me just as much as they hated every dark-skinned human being who was working in that program, because they hated welfare. Never mind the fact that there were other white kids in other programs. I had drawn the straw that got in the manual labor crowd. And they hated us one and all. Because when they looked, all they saw was that it was whale fire. Now, I came from a family that had never drawn a moment's welfare. What it was, though, was a make, it was a little WPA, it was a little CCC, probably CCC more like. It was a little CCC program that I think had come into being under the Carter administration, and they hadn't quite figured out a way to kill yet. So they hadn't figured out a way to zero it out in the budget, and so it was still there. And we sat in classrooms, and we took little multiple-choice tests to tell us about jobs that we would never be able to have because those jobs were gone and weren't coming back. I may have mentioned that my hometown at the time had a higher unemployment rate than any other city in the United States save Detroit, Michigan. And so there weren't going to be any drill press operators. And there weren't going to be any more furnace foremen. And there weren't going to be any more furnace operators or rolling mill operators. And tool and die was a word that had gone from that area and would never return. But we were there being taught about them. And after that first week of classroom sessions and Briggs-Myers testing and or Myers-Briggs or whatever and all of that stuff, off we went to pick up trash in the city parks, tidy things up a bit, ride around in the back of trucks, and eventually to lay sod over what had been the baseball field I played on a few years earlier as a boy. That was a hell of an America. It was an America that had really had an opportunity, as Scott notes, to take a good, hard look at itself and make things better, not just for a privileged few, but for the lot of America. Or it could start doing shots from the laudanum bottle and wait for morning in the city on the hill. And the morning was Hollywood lighting, and the city was a Trompe l'Oeil backdrop painted on still wet, freshly painted, freshly sized canvas. Yeah. And so it is, and this is why it fit in so nicely to have Scott's note to begin the program. So it is that earlier today I saw a news story out about John whoever, the Squeaker of the House, from an interview that he gave on CNN's Parker Spitzer last night. Why this Parker Spitzer program would want him, well, I guess I understand. Hell, the night before they were the only cable news outlet that actually ran Michelle Bachmann's odd little beady-eyed frenzy. But John Boehner showed up on Parker Spitzer to talk about how to talk about that fascist, Lominist Kenyan Muslim. And he said, in regard to the State of the Union,
well, they refused to talk about American exceptionalism. We are different than the rest of the world. Why? Because Americans have... The country was built on an idea... that ordinary people could decide what their government looked like, and ordinary people could elect their own leaders. And 235 years ago, that was a pretty novel idea. And so we're different. But why is our economy still 20 times the size of China's? Because Americans have had the freedom to succeed, the freedom to fail. We've got more innovators, more more entrepreneurs. And that is exceptional. But you can't get the left to talk about it. They don't. They reject that notion. Oh, my Aunt Edna's Edsel. For the love of God, please. That's the boner response. That's the boner response to the State of the Union. The State of the Union that talked about a Sputnik moment and about how we sent a man to the moon and how we did, Apollo rockets and everything. But it wasn't, Americanly exceptional enough for John Boner. It wasn't Americanly exceptional enough, I guess, because I don't know, because the Barack Obama didn't eat a flag. I'm kind of at a loss. That's weird. And typical, just typical. Because I hate to break it to you. Well, I'm not breaking anything to you. The only thing I'm breaking anything to, the only people I'm breaking are the little right-wing weirdos who still listen to this program from time to time and are not allowed on the air. There's nothing for America to be exceptional about right now. We are exceptional. Our privileged class is exceptionally greedy. Both of our parties largely are exceptionally corrupt. There are a handful of non-corrupt ones in one of the parties, but the Republican Party is exceptionally, exceedingly, wholly, and entirely corrupt. The only exceptionalism in America right now is exceptionalism that you really don't want to talk about. We are exceptionally cruel to those that we deem to have violated the law. We are exceptionally indifferent to people who are going hungry. We are exceptionally obsequious to the corporations that apparently now dictate both law and policy. But to suggest... No, because, you see, all we've been told by the right wing is, no, we can't. If I recall correctly, John Boner himself stood up in the House of Representatives not too many months back and screamed, no, we can't. A country whose country for whom the rallying cry of one party is no, we can't, is not a country that is manifesting anything in the way of exceptionalism. Except to say that that party is exceptionally into self-defeat. Why can't we figure out a way not to brutalize Social Security, even though it's not broken, even though it is fiscally sound up into, what did Harry Reid say, 2070, 2078? Jesus, by then we ought to all be flying around in George Jetson jetpacks and having Jane take the wallet from us and leave us with the one chrono dollar bill. It won't be that way, of course. It won't be that way in the slightest inkling for the vast majority of us. Now, granted, our privileged class, they may very well be flying around on jetpacks. Hell, they may be able to have spare parts bodies
and just get a, you know, a new liver when they've drunk one of them to death. They may live in domes by then, with the highly acidified seas lapping at their edges, while we proles scramble among the rocks for the last crumbs of soylent red, in hopes of the new release of soylent green. But John Boehner's party doesn't even want something as present world technology as rapid rail mass transit between Cincinnati and Cleveland. Via Columbus, all aboard! They don't want a simple rail line that runs from Madison to Green Bay. It's hard to suggest that anything, that any party that thinks like that has any business referring to itself as exceptional. Largely because it's so stunningly unexceptional. There's nothing exceptional in wanting to gut the single program that does more to stave off old age, poverty, and penury than any other program in the United States. And still we persist in being suckered into that discussion instead of saying, why don't you shut the up, there's nothing wrong with it, and let's get busy talking about why a significant percentage of Americans aren't paying Social Security taxes on all of their income. Why don't we talk about that? Because the minute we start making everybody pay Social Security taxes on all of their income, Social Security will get well. It's not just that the right wing wants to protect the rich. They want to keep Social Security from becoming obviously solvent forevermore. Because then what would happen? It's the same thing that motivates their desperate desire to repeal the Affordable Care Act. They desperately hope to see it fail before it can succeed. Because if it succeeds, then people will start feeling about health care the way they feel about Social Security, and they feel still quite strongly about Social Security. You know that to be true when even the teabaggers say they would rather raise taxes than raise the retirement age. And they have, in fact, said exactly that. We can have American exceptionalism, but to have it, we have to stop with the American defeatism. And defeatism is all that flows out of that mighty sewer that is the Repig-Lickin' Party. We can't have health care. We can't have Social Security. We can't have Medicare. We can't have light rail. We can't have bridges that don't crumble under the cars that are driving across them. We can't have clean air. We can't have clean water. We can't have decent education. I'm not going to sit here and do the whole litany of right-wing can't. Ooh, a double entendre. Because you can do it as well as I. We can have amazing things. We can have America be America again, as the poet said. But we cannot have it as long as creepy, weepy, old psychopaths like John Boehner are in office. For God's sakes, the president, not sure, stood there at the podium and referenced the fact that a black kid could become president a hard scrabble loudmouth from Scranton could become vice president, and a bartender's son from Ohio could become Squeaker of the House. And yet somehow that isn't exceptionally American enough for John Boehner. Cossack, you're right. I'm glad you reminded me. In the chat room, Cossack says, we can have nothing because everybody, one, two, three, they want it all. Enough said? Could be. So that's where we begin this evening. It is certainly not where we stop. But it is where we begin. And your phone calls are, of course, welcome. You know the number, 877-443-2366, 877, the numeral 4, head on your nickel, 304-658-3333. Jump right in. We've got 2.5 hours of program ahead of us. It'll be a lot easier to get the conversations in if you dial up now and form up the line and the queue or whatever, and we go one by one through the calls, as opposed to waiting until 5 minutes before the program ends and then deciding that you'd want to get your licks in. Right? Yeah. Email comes in, by the way, to Bob Kincaid, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D, at gmail.com. This is America's listener-supported, hint, hint, nudge, nudge, listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
just a dugout that my dad built in case the Reds decide to push the button down. 22 minutes before the hour. Don't blame me. It's one of my Desert Island records, Donald Fagen's The Night Fly. You know I'll use any opportunity I can to play a track from it. Yeah. By the way, before I go to the phones, breaking news. Any of you who want to send congratulatory emails or, hey, Bob, you were right, or let's pay attention to headline, court allows Emanuel on ballot for Chicago mayor. This makes it more and more likely that Chicago will be able to talk for a few years about the mayor Ramses. The Supreme Court of the state of Illinois, the highest court of the state of Illinois, has overturned the appellate court ruling that said he was not eligible to run and has ordered Rahm Emanuel's name placed on the Chicago mayoral ballot. So there you go. I told you. No offense, I'm not rubbing it in with him. I told you. I don't just say things. Let's go to the phones. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, how you doing?
Pretty good. How about you?
Yeah, well, I'm just trying to get my head wrapped around the whole mess, to be honest with you. I found sort of a drawback to having the smartphone after having it a short time now. I may be overexposing myself to too much talk.
I don't know. I suppose that's possible.
Well,
depends on what the exposure is. If it's Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and Beck, you know, your brain will just atrophy and turn into thin gray settling sloshing between your ears.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm trying to follow bits and pieces on the other side as well, but not to that extent. But I guess what I'm saying is it's just overwhelming, and I don't understand what has happened to the point that when did Americans all of a sudden become so wussified that they're scared to death and the sky is falling, and what is all this doom and gloom crap coming out of these people? I don't get it.
Which doom and gloom? You know,
Social Security is going to end, and, we're going to go bankrupt, and,
Well, that's not the American people doing that, Ike. That's not the American people doing that. That is closely, carefully honed messaging spewing out of computers and servers all up and down K Street in Washington, D.C., and going out to the vast network of right-wing blatherheads and all the way down into the pulpits of the churches. That's how that gets out. That's because they've got us sideways from Sunday in terms of getting their message out.
Yeah, and the unfortunate part is all the automatons and Stepford wives that run around parroting all this crap. All I can tell them is, you know, we've got plenty of assets in this country, from what I understand, somewhere a few years back, 2-3 years back, the numbers were somewhere around $68 trillion, which as of, at the same time the report was done, they pointed out that the top 2% top 5% were controlling $48 trillion of that money. And when you put that up against $14 trillion, it's a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, like nothing.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, just like you say, cut the crap out, man. I don't understand. Look, okay, here's my point. This is what I've been trying to get across. Yeah, to many different venues, and I still can't get any traction with it. So you tell me if I'm crazy. Picture an economy that's got a built-in bulge of labor at the bottom and middle, okay? And take that same economy, and you've got your goods being supplied by a third-world nation where they make even less than the people they're selling to. So obviously the standard of living is not a whole hell of a lot better on the other end. But you construct a fake economy at the bottom, and then you wonder how it is that you're going to lose in your will and in your greatness or in your standard of living and your progress, etc. How can you do that? How does an economy like that work?
How do you talk about American exceptionalism when not a tenth, but 1% of the entire population is warehoused in prisons? How do you talk about American exceptionalism? And you can't. American exceptionalism that the right wing wants to talk about is it's a fabrication inside their own fevered minds.
Ron in Raleigh just dropped a line, Ike, and said, once again, our two-tiered system rears its head. Do you think if it was you or I trying to get on the ballot in Chicago, the court would bend itself in twain to put us there? And the answer is no. We have a multi-tiered America. You know, the fact that we don't have official castes such as they have in India does not mean that we do not have a caste-based system in this country.
Yeah, you know, I agree with you there. I'm dumbfounded to the point that, and I don't understand, and I guess I never will, how is it that supposedly a piece of paper from a college entitles you to a guaranteed good living, which I think everybody knows in the back of their mind that's probably a joke, too.
Well, it doesn't guarantee you that. And, in fact, the piece of paper from the college is proving to be more and more worthless because of the fact that, that study that came out that our good friend Matt Osborne referenced not too long back that indicated that a significant percentage of people who start college have the same cognitive failings coming out of college that they had going in. That's not education serving its purpose.
I'm so discombobulated. I'm lost here. I just don't understand where it became such a detriment or such a shame to be a person, you know, that lives in a society that, maybe has some college and what have you, in my case, but would rather do what he does. You know, I take it like, you know, when you see the guy riding on the back of the garbage truck, do you look at him like, hey, you're a loser? When you see somebody building a house, do you look at them where is all this disrespect for real labor coming from? Because I can tell you, manufacturing jobs are like a special seventh circle of hell if you've never worked on an assembly line. Trust me, that's no piece of cake or anything.
Well, that's the question. I think that's the answer to the question that you ask. We have, over the course of something on the order of 8, 16, 20, over the last 20, 30 years, we have come to a conclusion somehow that we don't want to be a country that makes things, that we want to be a country that shuffles somebody else's money, that we want to be a country. Do you remember the use of the phrase the service economy? I do.
Yeah.
That's we don't want to make things because I guess making things is icky, and having single wage earner households. Well, that single wage earner households are bad for the country. They're bad for the Republican Party, which is deemed bad for the country, if you understand what I'm saying. Because what you want is to multiply the labor pool sufficiently that you can make sure that everybody is down and desperate. And once you eliminate the good-paying manufacturing jobs, then, well, you're well on the way. And if you don't have an industrial manufacturing policy in place, then they're never coming back. And you augment that by doing things like happens here in Appalachia and take the metallurgical steel reserves, and instead of holding them to support the regrowth of, say, a steel industry, you sell it off as quickly as you can to the Russians, the India, and the Chinese so that you make sure that there can never be a steel industry reborn in the United States, even though the steel that is made here is made far more cleanly and far more ecologically soundly than it is anywhere else on the planet, and it benefits more people better. But you don't do that. And it's incredibly frustrating.
I think we're getting to a tipping point quick. I hate to say it, but I think a tipping point's coming, and I just don't think, I look at what's going on over in Tunisia and Cairo and the rest of those places, and I just wonder if maybe some of the oligarchs in this country aren't starting to get, just a wee bit to the sweat side of it.
No, Ike, they are not even scratching the backs of their necks, because it will not happen here. I'm not going to say it cannot happen here. I'm saying it will not happen there, and there is in here, and there is a nuance of difference to that. And the nuance comes in the fact that the people who are in the streets in Cairo are there because they've been left nowhere else to go. They're in the streets in Cairo because they don't have really good cable. They're in the streets in Cairo because they haven't been completely anesthetized by a corporatized media messaging machine that keeps them at home. But most importantly, they haven't been debt terrorized. Again, I will restate what I've said on a million other occasions. and that is this. The reason that what passes for protest in the United States involves showing up at some open space on Saturday and being back at work by Monday is because if we don't, we lose the boat, we lose the house, we lose the car, the credit rating goes to hell, the cable goes off, we can't pay our cell phone bill, the internet goes out, and everything else that keeps us tied to that debt. Well, you know what?
Yep.
That ain't the case in Egypt. It's not in the case where the trouble's beginning to brew in Yemen. And that's because they didn't figure out how to anesthetize their people when they had an opportunity to. But the United States, we are completely anesthetized, Ike. Ain't nobody putting their feet in the street that has a job they got to be there for on Monday. Ain't gonna happen.
Yeah. Not to mention the no-fly list and God knows all the other little tricks they've got in their bag these days.
I was frankly tickled pink to find out that I actually got a passport. I can't tell you the freedom that I felt when I got that little. I've got it in my hands right now, because it means that I can, as long as I haven't done anything nasty, I can get out of here.
Yeah, I've got mine as well, and yeah, I continue to look at Australia, but it's just not feasible.
You know what? It doesn't for me. That's the nice thing for me. It doesn't have to be Australia. For me, it could be any number of places, because there are any number of places that are better. It could even be somewhere colder than here, which would be a real downer, but, you know.
I'm just thinking about the work. They had 300,000 structures or whatever the hell it was go underneath water over there. There's plenty of work over there. Trust me, they need tradesmen and craftsmen in that country. But, you know, just to sum it up, I guess I'll say, look, you know, they continue to tell me it's all about my choices. Well, let me run them down for you real fast. I worked in the automobile manufacturing industry for Chrysler on an assembly line, and they sent that job to Mexico 2 weeks after they got their loan guarantee government money from Reagan. Okay? I was in the steel business, and they almost killed Pittsburgh. They almost killed United States Steel when they started flooding us with foreign steel. So that went through the floor. So the last thing was, you know, you talk about jobs. Well, there's jobs here that have to be done here. And I figured, hey, I get into construction. They can't send the building out to get it painted and maintenance and whatever. I can do that here. And then they flood me with illegal and cheap labor from all over the world and wherever they come from. I'm not going to single out any particular group, but if you want to know who I'm talking about, just stop by any construction site anywhere along the way in your travels, and you'll see who I'm talking about. And they just whipped the rug right out from underneath me. We build 401ks, they find a way to take the money. We agree to pensions, you know, through our employers back in the day, and they turn around and go bankrupt, and boom, your pension's gone. Every time it turns around, they find it. Just, if you're clawing your way up, they find another way to pull you right back down or to keep you down. They're, you know, and this Republican idea, I'll tell you what, half of me says let them go, start raving lunatic, mad crazy, and cut and slash and burn just as bad as they want to do it. You know, let them do it. Sign a death warrant for themselves, because that's what they'll be doing, a political death warrant. I should make sure I...
Yes, do let's. We're trying to eliminate the eliminationism in the language around here.
Yeah, but I mean, in a political venue. But anyway, be that as it may, I don't know. I got two suggestions for you for songs.
All right.
If you ever happen to run across them. One's Caught in a Trap, because I'm just old and it just keeps ringing in my ears.
Oh, I've played that. Elvis? Hell yeah.
Yeah. And the other one, I think I told you this one before.
I think the actual title of that is Suspicious Minds.
That's right. Traded Dylan for dollars in cable TV, because that's what happened to the 60s hippies, and that's what happened to the activists. They got high, they sold out, they melted in, a lot of them melted into the system, and they left all the rest of us standing here with, hey, what happened to the movement?
Well, and just remember that after for some people, after griping about the man and all of that, hang on. Yeah, nobody needed that. After griping about the system and the man and whatnot, if you kind of slow down for a minute and step inside the system, and they give you the little neck rub and the weekly paycheck, all of a sudden you look up and go, wait a minute, it's kind of nice. I think I'll watch TV for a while. And the next thing you know, watching TV for a while turns into 30 years later. Ike, you have a good night.
You too, buddy. I appreciate it.
Uh-huh. Bye now. You know, the thing about the labor replacement argument that I likes to make is that it ignores the fact that labor is there because of government desire to drive down wages. And I've said it before, let me say it again. Look at the undocumented immigration problem in any given state and correlate that to whether or not that state has a so-called right to work law. Because right to work is right to work for less. And eventually you find this break point where folks can't. So they go elsewhere, and that labor vacuum is filled by people who do and will, because they are content to live 15 to a room and mail the money home to mama. And I won't blame that on workers. I blame that on the thug bastards who did that, who created that scenario by deliberate design. And it's right-wingers and repig-licking, we need a right to work law. Because we don't need no unions. Right? And then you wind up with some unions who do things like, never mind. There are good unions still out there. And I don't want to make the mistake of lumping any good ones in with the ones that are bad there. So onward to the next call. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hey, what's up?
Hey, Will from Chicago here, coming to you.
I'd know that voice anywhere.
Yep. Yes, my voice is said to be able to be distinguished in a crowd of thousands, coming to you from just outside the city of Chicago. I was not surprised by the Rahm Emanuel decision, based on my understanding of the residency rules, but when you have former governors like Jim Thompson taking a full-page ad in the Springfield, Illinois newspaper urging the Supreme Court to please rule in favor of Rahm Emanuel, chances are that even apart from the law, it's going to be on Rahm's side. I am ironically reminded of an old Russian saying. There's rich man's justice and poor man's justice. It is better to be rich.
Exactly. And our buddy Cossack used to have a SIG line on his email, a quote from Bat Masterson that I just love. He said everything, something like, everything happens equally for everyone here. Take for instance, ice. Everyone gets the same. The poor get theirs in winter, and the rich get theirs in summer.
Precisely. And unfortunately, what we've ended up with in this country the last 40 years is more social stratification. In many ways, we are back to where we were circa 1928 in terms of how much wealth is controlled in the hands of a few. I believe it's 1% of the nation controls 23% of the wealth. We have a deterioration of working rights and laws. Essentially, we're back to the 1920s and the leadership of the Republican Party and their backers, such as the Koch brothers, seem to want to take us back to the 1890s or earlier. Some, I think, want to declare themselves lords and make us serfs, and I wouldn't be all that shocked if Dick Cheney secretly has a fantasy for himself to be declared pharaoh. Build a monument to his ego bigger than the pyramids.
You know, if you study the legal history of the United States, there are little benchmarks of progress, and back in the era that you're referring to, that's when you come up with cases like Lochner, and it was a hateful opinion by the Supreme Court, Will, that attacked the right of working people to bargain collectively for their own well-being, and that's what they're after. If you could just sodium pentothal the Republican Party up. And, you know, it doesn't matter what of those signature wedge issues they favor, whether it's abortion or guns or gay folk or any of those other things. But if you could just sodium pentothal a lot of them up, they would tell you the thing that they want to do most, if they could, would be to repeal the Wagner Act, would be to repeal the National Labor Relations Act, send in the skullcrackers, and end that shit once and for all, and put working people back where they belong, desperate, starving, and working 72-hour weeks.
Yeah, pretty much. I think the GOP could easily rename themselves the Committee to Restore the 1890s because, let's face it, they have essentially become the party of religious conservatives to try to give themselves a sense of morality, even though I find very few religious conservatives who always act in a moral manner. Certainly James Dobson and his ilk don't, and they use this as a facade to hide the gospel of wealth, namely that if you are wealthy, God gave you your wealth. Tom Hartman has referred to it as Calvinism on steroids, but I mean, let's face it. I think
how come I never get credit for coming up with terms like neo-Calvinism? I did that a couple of years ago. I'm not gooning on you, Will. But
no problem. But neo-Calvinism would be a good thing. But I'm going to coin another one, which is more accurate, neo-mammonism, namely that their god is greed.
Yes,
they need
absolutely.
They need to be, as was said in our chat room, the ones who have it all. They have to have all the wealth, all the power, because if they are not in control, good heavens, they might have equals. Good heavens, people unlike them might have the same access and importance in society. It is egotism writ large, written letters so big that they could be seen on the surface of the moon. And what we are dealing with are essentially people who haven't developed past adolescence on a psychological level. Essentially, we have the big man on campus still stuck at the same age of mental development, even if his body is 50 or 60, and then we have selling that you too can one day be like the ultra wealthy, so shouldn't you support policies that favor them? I mean, it's a whole lot of trickle-down economics, the belief that, yes, we should do things to protect the wealthy because by some miracle we might make it, but it's a snow job. Socially, we are about as stratified as Great Britain. You have more chance of moving up in most of the EU if you are born at the lowest rung of power, moving to the height of wealth, than you do here in the U.S. And it used to be that this was a country where you could rise up, but instead we've cut everything off. We have decided to follow a failed economic theory, which if it was a medical theory would be thrown out, namely the free market is magical. The free market only exists because we have regulations to enforce contracts. And Adam Smith, in his work, The Wealth of Nations, noted that it is a fact that when four or six business people get together, they will conspire on prices. So even he admitted there was a need for regulation, and there was also a need to look after the national interest. But the ultra-wealthy don't care about nations. They now a class into themselves. You're not happy with the laws here? Great. Go to Dubai and reset up Halliburton. I mean, we do.
And you know, Will, I joke a lot about going somewhere else and wishing that Canada would make the Turks and Caicos part of a Canadian province. But the fact of the matter is, there's that old saying that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world gets the flu.
Yeah.
And it used to be said in an economic context, and I suppose this still is economic, but remember, we are dealing with transnational corporate behavior and transnational corporate ambitions. And to that end, there's nowhere on the planet that's really safe. You know, Scott writes in from Sweden and tells us about the enlightened state of affairs there. And we've got listeners in Norway who talk about it there. John Fox can talk about what he experiences, as well as our other listeners in Australia, and on and on. But the fact of the matter is, it's starting here, because if the transnationals can accomplish it here, slowly but surely they can then turn around and use the strength of the United States to strangle social safety nets and in enlightened public policy everywhere on the planet. Will everywhere on
exactly.
The planet,
they want a global empire with themselves at the top and the rest of us as servants, as they've always wanted for centuries. I mean, it's been a different outfit year after year, century after century, but the goal remains the same: reestablish feudalism. They want to be lords, and they want us as serfs, because they can't accept a world of equals. And
I'm not being disagreeable to be disagreeable, or disagreeing to be disagreeable. It's not even that they can't stand a world of equals. They can't stand a world of the working class existing and having a tolerable level of leisure. You know, here we are in a country where, you know, the multi-millions upon millions of hours of television are watched every day, and most of it is vacuous trash. And even in that environment, the corporate, the transnationals and their Republican enablers can't stand the idea of organized labor. And I would submit to you that that is because that is still not enough. They want workers desperate, hungry, thirsty, starving, scared.
Exactly, because we have to be needy, because if we are content, we can make trouble. Remember, in the 1970s, several of the leading conservatives thought that there was too much democracy, there was too much power in the middle class, and the way to limit democracy is get rid of your middle class. This way they won't rise up demanding rights for black people, for women, for gays, for others, and we can go back to excluding whoever we want from our country clubs. If they are miserable and struggling to survive, they won't be able to cause any difficulties.
And all of those things that you just mentioned, Will, you know, the country clubs and whatnot, that's not hyperbole on your part. I want people to understand that there is a right-wing laundry list of things that, you know, when they talk about taking our country back, they're talking about wanting black and white water fountains. They just won't say it publicly. They want separate accommodations. They want separate but equal, because they are still mad about having it taken away in the first place. It's just like Social Security. When Social Security was passed in the 1930s with no Republican cooperation whatsoever, they swore then, we will tell our sons will tell our grandsons will tell our great-grandsons will tell our great-great-grandsons, and we will remember this day until the day that we destroy it and put America back to it. And that's what they mean by country back. And the same thing obtains with race relations, gender relations, everything. Because that's that social aspect of it, not the economic aspect, but that social aspect of it is driven by the fear that rides just under the surface of their social consciousness, that they know, and we know, and they know we know, that their white little world is going away. It is going away,
exactly.
Will.
Yep.
Leave it to Beaver is going to be buried.
Yes. Here's the thing. When I saw the Republicans decide, okay, we're going to have an anti-immigrant campaign and let's annoy the Hispanic voters, I told myself they are signing their death warrant as a party. I hate to go over the top. Let's say they are signing their firing papers as a party for 30, 40 years from now, because when America is no longer a white majority nation, however you define white, how are they going to appeal to people they've annoyed? They've annoyed African Americans, except for Michael Steele and J.C. Watts. There's only a relatively small number of Hispanics in the party, and most other groups and among other groups, there's not all that support. So really, I think they are following a failing strategy that demographics argues against. I've had no illusion they want to go back to the past. There's someone I know who's 90 and still sharp as a tack, and he remembers the day when, just because he's Jewish, he couldn't go to some of the country clubs in the Chicago area. And when was that era? 1950s, 1960s.
It ain't that long ago.
Not that long ago. And guess what? It wasn't that long ago when you could have someone who was in the U.S. Army, served a full combat tour of duty, showed up in Montgomery, Alabama, or Atlanta, Georgia, and could not eat at the finest restaurant in town, no matter if he had saved the lives of 100 men.
For a reminder of that, all you need to do is look at the biography of Nat King Cole.
Exactly. I mean, heck, Jonas Salk in San Diego in the 50s, after he had invented his polio vaccine, could not move in to the neighborhood near the university because there was a clause against Jewish people living there. Nat King Cole, I mean, when I first learned of the discrimination he faced in trying to get a house for himself and his kid, my reaction was, please, this must, for any right-thinking American of that time, it must have been a national embarrassment. And yet, we have people who want to go back to that. We are an exceptional nation only insofar that there are moments when we choose to confront our faults and flaws and say, enough, we are going to try to make justice. Have we succeeded entirely? No. But when we follow that urge, we can become a great example to others. You probably don't care much for scriptural quotes, but there's one that applies. Not by might, not by power, but by spirit. When we follow the spirit of our best ideals, we rise up and become a nation that is worthy of admiration. When we just simply pursue wars of convenience to secure resources or other trivial things, when we do not raise up the poor among us, when we say it doesn't matter that we have tens of millions without health care insurance and many who will not go to bed secure in shelter or food, we fail as a nation. So I think ultimately we are going to see the GOP fail in its agenda. I expect some year we will have people get smart and either protest or just vote. It might take a lot more suffering because people are complacent and afraid. That's a unique thing that we have here. Not only are people complacent, they are terrified. But
let me give you a counterpoint, if I may, Will.
Sure.
We are not that far from a lot of awful things. But as I sit here talking to you, I'm looking at a photograph on my computer. It is a group photograph of a mass of people. Down in the lower right-hand corner of this photograph, cracked and in sepia tones, is the stamp Oak Hill, which is a town not far from here across the river. Oak Hill, 1924. And in this photograph, there is a milling mass of humanity in the foreground. But the body of the photograph consists of a square, probably two or three deep, of Klansmen. In the center of the square is another group of Klansmen forming the outline of a cross. At the back of the photograph, there are three blazing crosses. Three Klansmen hold American flags over their shoulders, on one side and three on another. Three Klansmen are astride horses, and one man stands alone facing the camera. They're all faceless. They are all too distant to tell. But the man standing alone is my grandfather. And I look at that photograph a lot, Will. And I know, I never got to know the man, but I know who my grandfather was, and I know what he was about. He was fairly well respected. And he was, for his time, I know people will think it crazy, pretty liberal. And he was a Democrat. He led, even though he was a Klansman, he led the camp, he was a big supporter of Al Smith in his presidential bid against Herbert Hoover, even though Al Smith was a Roman Catholic. But I have that in my history, and it's something I have to deal with.
Yeah.
I guess maybe it would be like being the grandson or great grandson of a member of the Waffen-SS in Germany. But I will submit to you that while we are not that far removed from a lot of nastiness, as long as the grandson of a grand dragon can become a fairly well-respected liberal talk host in this country, there might be just a smattering of hope.
There's always hope, and it's up to us to make it real. Bob, keep it real, and a shout-out to the friends in the chat room, since I think I lost my internet connection here. Guys, also brief reminder, if you can support the horn, donations are appreciate it. And remember, it's up to us to make a difference, because if not us, who?
Indeed. Thank you, Will.
Bye.
Take care. Bye now. And I don't beat on that Klan picture a whole bunch. But I also don't deny the reality of my life. And that is it. And I guess you could say that, maybe I'm working some of it off. Is that fair? Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob?
Yes.
Andy, Redwood City.
Hey, Andy, what's up?
Not much. That's some story you had there.
The first time I saw that and realized what it was a little creepy, believe me.
Now, it is a, I did know my grandfather, and I'll tell you, people of the older generation were very, very prejudiced. I mean, there's no question it was a whole other environment. My grandfather had a band, actually played in the New York area, New Jersey area, and he did have a black gentleman in the band with him. My grandfather sang and played the drums. And they did. My grandmother used to say how much of a problem they had with this black gentleman in the band, because of course they had so many problems. A lot of times they'd see this black guy, and they weren't allowed to play at the venue that they had signed up. And at the time in the 20s, when they did that in early 30s, to make money to compensate from their factory jobs, that was a big deal. And you know, a lot of times just because they had a black man in the band, it was verboten. They couldn't travel. They couldn't go to hotels with them.
Yeah, and early on, baseball teams after Jackie Robinson, baseball teams faced similar problems trying to go into the South. And not just the South. Let's remember that these issues are issues that largely extend all over the United States. It is not a Southern problem. It's just
right.
The South talked about them, frankly, a little more honestly than the rest of the country did.
Right. There was massive segregation in the New York, New Jersey area. And my grandfather, even though he was good friends with, you know, when he was good friends with this gentleman in the band, overall, when I listened to my grandfather talk about other races, it was...
Yeah, it wasn't pretty.
As a child, it wasn't pleasant. He was not pleasant. I was always amazed about how outright racist he was. Anyway. And it was normal operating procedure. Anyway, I want to bring up, did you see an article by Adam Hochschild in the New York Times? It was on January 17th, an editorial. Priest Lumumba?
Yes. Yes, I did.
Assassination?
Yeah, and the fact that we've kind of, our hand in it?
Well, it was done partially by the CIA,
yeah,
helped bring it down, and of course the British as well with their, or actually it was the Belgian.
Yeah, it was the
influence of Belgian king because of was the Belgian Congo or the Republic of the Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo. But also in that article, I was interesting to see that there was a mention of George H.W. Bush and him saying how Joseph Mobutu, who was the dictator that they throw in there that the United States always manages to do, how he was one of our most valued friends in the world. The quote by George H.W. Bush.
Yes.
I just want
to... As I noted on the show last night, Andy, we are so uniformly right at getting these things wrong. We don't just bumble into getting it wrong. We're good at it. We're past masters. Did you happen to see Hillary Clinton's quote in speaking to the Arab leaders 3 weeks ago?
She started changing her tune over Mubarak, because it looks like, I think the Egyptians are going to bring him down.
Well, and the guy who wants to step into that vacuum is already there. I don't know if you noticed that Mohammed al-Baradei arrived today.
I think the same thing. I think he's going to be in. And I think they're going to take Mubarak. I think they've had enough of his...
But what Hillary said, Hillary was speechifying and lecturing Arab leaders. She might have been, I forget if she was in Bahrain or Qatar or where, Doha. Doha's in Qatar. But she told them that, you know, you've got to open up your social media and you've got to do more for your people. She said, people with the opening of the information age, people are finding out that vast amounts of the wealth in your countries are going to a very few people.
Thanks to WikiLeaks too.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. But that line just kind of gobsmacked me.
Because,
what? Wait, no, because I wanted to, I just
what
saw...
What about here, Hillary?
Duh! And, you know, to be fair, she's on the side that wants Social Security not to die. But by the same token, the wage stagnation, the actual loss in middle-class liquidity and equity, she's been part of it.
You were talking about Ike earlier. And talking about, and also with Will, about getting ahead in the United States, and the and Will had brought up too that there is a stagnation of class now in the United States, where it's very difficult to move out of class. But and I owe this to Robert Scheer, because I've heard Robert Scheer talk. If you know who Robert Scheer is,
yes,
does left, right, and center. The way the Clintons got ahead, here you have a kid that grows up, you know, goes to Oxford, does well at school, becomes a governor. And also Hillary coming out of pretty much from Scranton, PA, although her father was more than middle class. But how you get ahead when you're the Clintons is what you have to do is you suck up to the power. You do what the power elite want. This is the same thing and the Quisling in the White House is doing now. He's taking a page out of the Clinton playbook. Rahm Emanuel is the same way. You suck up to Wall Street. You suck up to the power, and you stick it to the working class, stick it to the middle class, kick them around, and you make it look like you're not doing it, that you're doing them good. The same as Obama is doing with his language. He is just catering, he's on his knees to the corporate elite, the same as the Clintons are. That's how you get ahead in America.
The question I have to ask though, Andy, is and this is a product of my schooling and my upbringing, I freely admit. When you get that close to that kind of power, is it possible not to?
I think if it is possible, it is
incredibly difficult to.
If you are Franklin Roosevelt, and you come out of that class, you can stick it to that class, and you can come back at them, and you can fight for working people in the middle class. But you watch Obama when he is like looking at a Jeff Immelt or with a high-level executive, he beams at them. He is in awe of their power. He genuflexed to them. Same as...
And see, let me point out an example, if I may, Andy.
Jeff Immelt.
The only person I can think of offhand who has occupied the presidency who did not do that much sucking up in recent memory or in my lifetime...
Probably Jimmy Carter.
...is Jimmy Carter.
Absolutely.
Look what happened to Jimmy Carter.
Right.
If you want your two terms, the nature of the system in the United States is such that if you do not bow and scrape and kowtow and do the appropriate forelock tugging for the capital class in this country, you're not going to go anywhere. See, I think that's, and you know, it doesn't have to remember. The Bushes, we like to, you know, Malloy likes to call them the Bush family evil empire, or
because
the Bush crime family,
they
and Bart Kopp calls them the Bush family evil empire, because they are.
They're behind everything.
They're evil, but they are climbers. You gotta remember, when we talk about the Bushes, you gotta remember.
They don't have to climb. They've been there for 100 years at the top.
We're coming up on near the 100th anniversary. They were nobodies, though, Andy, until one of them got appointed to the War Materiels Board in the First World War.
Is when it all started.
Before that, they had been nobody. They had been nobody. Congregationalist preachers, and merchants, and so forth. The Walkers were by far the more powerful than the Bushes.
But that Congregational preacher did go to Yale.
Yeah, because that was originally the Yale mission.
Right.
But what happens? Even that wasn't enough. You know, Barbara Bush, whose maiden name was Pierce.
Pierce.
She was distantly related to Franklin Pierce, you know, one of the great nobody presidents of the United States.
He was, by historians, he was the worst president we ever had.
Yeah. And, but they were, you know, they were financially, they were all, they teetered financially and all of that. And they were climbers. You know, there's that story in Kitty Kelly's book about how the Bushes gave the Reagans a cowboy boot sculpture at Christmas, and Nancy just thought it was the tackiest damn thing she'd ever seen in her life and tucked it away behind the toilet or something. And you know, that pearl-clutching old beast Babs is still pissed about it. But they were. They're climbers and graspers. And they got their entree into the you know, real folding, walking around Jed Clampett money the same way, by fawning upwards. And there, you know, Kennedy could do some of what Kennedy did, coming from the same place that FDR did. You know, he could needle his own class. He also succeeded in leveraging some of the better angels of the nature of his own class, but he clearly went too far, and they succeeded in doing to Kennedy what they failed in doing to Roosevelt. If you recall the plot against Roosevelt, that they invited Smedley Butler, the coup, that they invited Smedley Butler to lead.
Right, right. But one thing about Kennedy, and I would love to get on the case of Hartman over this, that the Kennedys never were part of the Anglo elite. They were always outsiders because they were Irish and they were Catholic. And especially for Joe Kennedy, when he came in as the first head of the SEC, he was never really part of the Wall Street that made him the money that he made, although you could say that they made money. Kennedy's made money in other areas before that, but he never really fit in because he was Irish Catholic and he was a Democrat. And that's something that somebody like Tom Hartman fails to understand. That Kennedy have always been Democrats. They are not been Republicans. They are not Anglos. They never fit in. They've always had to scrape their way from the bottom to get to where they
right, were. Because they never fit the WASP model.
Absolutely. And some people who talk on talk shows should take that into consideration, and they don't seem to understand that.
I will remember that. I remember those sorts of things, Andy, and I will tuck that away because it is worth noting.
Yeah, I'm not referring to you.
No, I know you're not. You already said who you were referring to.
But, you know, in Obama's speech, too, I don't know if you've heard of Paul Lakoff from Berkeley.
Oh, sure.
The guy with the language stuff. If you listen to Obama's speech, he so much reinforced the Republican talking points, it made me just want to scream. made me want to scream. He just bowed down, and he's given the Republicans more and more credibility. He is moving us so far to the right and just disrespecting anything liberal or progressive. It is just popping my head. Cut corporate taxes. Freeze spending. Recession's over. Clean coal, which you mentioned. Medical malpractice reform. We will not relent on war. More free trade. Free trade's going to create 70,000 jobs. Where did he get that full baloney from? Open up ROTC on the campuses. Welcome those ROTC recruiters. The need to take the long-term cost of entitlements back. They are all Republican talking points, and he used them. Where were the progressive
talking points? I'll take it a step further, Andy. They are all fascist talking points.
Absolutely they are.
Okay?
Absolutely
And you know, I recognize what my reality is going to be in November of 2012. It doesn't bear going into here. But the fact...
We lose.
But the fact of the matter is, at this point in time, not, you know, it's, people will say, well, you know, the Democrats are as bad as the Republicans. I suppose you can make that argument, but if you make that argument, and this is the thrust of my contention, if you make that argument and stop, oh, the Democrats are as bad as the Republicans, and 9 times out of 10, that argument is coming out of the Republican camp. I've seen it for years. But if you take it and stop there, then you've missed the point of the exercise, and I don't mean you. Because that misses the underlying conceptualization. And that is that we are in some degree, some would say greater, some would say lesser, but only the self-deluded would say we're not, we are in some degree of imperial fascism. Because I argue from a political standpoint, all empires are fascist. Okay? It doesn't matter whether it's the British Empire or the Mussolini's Italy. All empires tend toward fascism if you are going to work with, if you're going to go from the working definition of fascism. So once you get to empire, you de facto get to fascism, and to one degree or another, both political parties are going to espouse fascist the principles. And there's no room in fascism for social safety nets. There's no room in fascism for universal single-payer health care. There's no room in fascism for any of that stuff. Although some fascist enterprises have, at least, as the historic saying goes, made the trains run on time. We can't even quite bring ourselves to make the trains run.
We don't have any trains.
Yeah.
And the ones we have are 50 years old.
You know, but I don't, to a certain extent, we are going to see government going forward, absent some sort of semi-miraculous sea change, we're going to see government going forward, Andy, that is to a lesser or greater degree fascist. The greater degree fascist will be accomplished by the Republicans. The lesser, more velvet-gloved fascism will be accomplished by the Democrats. But it's still going to be fascism.
Right.
That's why we're still in Afghanistan. Now, in the State of the Union speech, he said, we're getting out of Afghanistan starting this summer. But by God, that contradicts everything I have read from every general who's involved.
They have $11 billion to build 12 bases by 2012. What are they talking about? He even said during his speech, we won't relent on war. It's going to be never ending.
Right. We're in a perpetual war for perpetual peace. Right. Because among other things, that keeps at least a certain part of the potentially otherwise disaffected, unemployed population engaged in getting dead.
Right.
You know, I haven't talked about it, and if you don't mind, I'll kind of bring it up on your watch. I haven't talked about it. I saw this last Sunday. I happened to be going through the channels, and I saw the end of This Week with Christiana Monpour, or whatever it's being called.
She's good.
She's not bad, and you know, you can just see the freaks like you know, Boehner and those other right wing turds talking to her, and they just hate the fact that she's got that upscale accent. It drives them crazy because They sound like, it doesn't matter, they sound like rubes. But in the course, you know, they've got that thing they run every Sunday, at least remembering the fallen. You know what I'm talking about? The soldiers and people of note who have died during the week.
Sure.
And
well, looking at the ages, it's heartbreaking.
Yeah, well, I saw one, and it just grabbed me because of the way things are around here. Since Ferd, my son, was a little boy, we've talked about, you know, because sons are sons and fathers are fathers, you know, he's named after me. He's the second. And when he was little, he said, I want someday to have a son and he'll be the third. And then he started imagineering a little bit, and he said, and he wasn't talking real good because he was still quite young. And he said, and then we'll have Ferg the North. He meant the fourth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at the history of, you know, royal houses and so forth, it's hard to get to the fourth of anything unless you're one of those Asian royal houses. Where you've got 92 wives like Genghis Khan, then you can get to the 4th and the 16th and the 23rd and so forth. But in the remembrance of the fallen last Sunday, there was a name listed, and he was from Texas, of course. Army Private First Class Ira B. Lanningham IV. And I saw that, Andy, and I just kind of stopped in my tracks. Because I had to because the minute I saw Ira B. Lanningham IV, age 22, of Zapata, Texas, I realized I had to stop and think about Ira B. Lanningham III and Ira B. Lanningham Jr. and Ira B. Lanningham. And you only get that sort of personal opportunity when it's somebody named after a previous parent. And there's so then I did the math real quick, and 11 minus 2 is 9, so Ira B. Lanningham IV was born in 1989. That means that Ira B. Lanningham IV's father or grandfather, more likely grandfather, who would be Ira B. Lanningham Jr., survived the Vietnam era, which means that Ira B. Lanningham I probably survived the Second World War or Korea.
Mm-hmm.
But there will be no Ira B. Lanningham V, Andy. And in that little moment of realization about a family about whom I knew absolutely nothing, I actually shed a tear. Because for some reason or another, that litany of names, that realization of names, was made, and maybe this marks me as shallow for only being able to do it because the kid had a Roman numeral after his name. But it became painfully real that family had worked really, really hard and with literal transgenerational dedication to make sure that a particular name was remembered in their family. And instead, Ira B. Lanningham IV, aged 22, of Zapata, Texas, assigned to the 2nd Battalion, 30th Infantry Regiment, 4th Brigade Combat Team of the 10th Mountain Division in Fort Polk, Louisiana, was blown to bits January the 7th, died of wounds suffered in Logar Province, Afghanistan, when insurgents attacked his unit using an improvised explosive device and small arms fire. Also killed was Army Specialist Ethan C. Hardin. And coming as he did from Zapata, Texas, I'll bet you that Ira B. Lanningham IV, I'll bet you that Ira B. Lanningham III, the second, or the first, one or all of those, I'll bet, were veterans. And they had a proud military tradition inside that family that will not include now an Ira B. Lanningham V. Because of a stupid little war based on profound ignorance of any sort of history of Central Asia, and particularly the lands once known as Bactria and which we now call Afghanistan. And it made me weep.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what? To the extent that they were, you know, yes, Ira B. Lanningham IV. But that horror, lest we forget, has been repeated thousands of times since 2001 in far-flung corners of the world where we had no business. Literally, we had no business. And I guess it's just going to continue because it's certainly not getting any nicer there. And Hamid Karzai ain't sobering up.
No, he's just a corrupt nepotism throughout that country in a narco state. And you know, they say that the GDP of Afghanistan is like less than $2 billion, yet we spend $133 billion a year there in the military. Tell me how that makes any sense.
Well, it doesn't. And that's something
products sold there. It's no economic significance, and we're putting in all this money that could so be used here. Have you heard of the New Priorities campaign, by the way?
No.
This is a new campaign being put together by grassroots organizations around the country. They've decided, basically, PDA is one of the groups.
Oh, Progressive Democrats, yeah.
Yeah, and labor organizations around the country. But they've decided that it looks like we're not having any effect on our leaders at the federal level or at the higher levels of government in persuading them to stop these wars. It just seems impossible. The House members, the Senate, it's just not working. It's not working. So they decided this new priorities campaign to try to get people at low-level position, mayors, councilmen, supervisors, any type of county, low-level positions to sign up this new priorities campaign where we stop the military spending, start cutting it back, and bringing it back into our local communities because it is just killing these wars, our local communities, and the size of our defense budget. You know, of course, being almost as big as the rest of the world combined, we're spending, again, this is this imperialism, and this is the empire, which you've talked about. And we're six times bigger than the next biggest military budget, which is China. We're six times bigger than even China. And this is just pure insanity. So this new priorities campaign, and I know they've got things going from Maine to California, is trying to get local political, anybody that gets voted into an office to sign up to this and work for this and get supported by the grassroots, because it's just not working at the upper levels of government. We're just not heard. I don't think they care. And we just got done talking about this. But they're in another, Obama's in another planet. I think he's so divorced from reality and so divorced about what's happening to the average American that it's like we're living on the moon compared to where he is. You know, there's just no connection with the leaders of our government. And that's what they've come to the conclusion. It's just not working. You know, we could have demonstrations till we're blue in the face, but you brought up good reasons too. Everybody's so locked into their jobs and just not willing to take the risk. But I do think there is hope, and I do think that something could break in this country and we could have another Tunisia. I don't think it'll take too much. Just a few things to happen to really break the safety net. And I think we could get some real headway into doing something.
Well, I would say that you are probably, and I know it sounds weird to describe it in this way, you are more optimistic than I am, Andy.
I don't mean to be quite honest with you, because I'm not very happy.
And you know, there's that old saying that you'll never go broke underestimating the American people.
Right. And this fascism thing, I've thought that since Reagan. I left the country for a couple of years myself. I did
I never have. Maybe it's time for me to try that.
And it is eye opening. I definitely see what I see where I go is there's a dignity for working people and dignity for older people and dignity for all people in other places, especially in Europe, in Western Europe. There is a dignity just for working people, and there is a dignity giving to older retired people, which I don't see here. I just do not see it here.
No, no, there's no dignity. If there was any dignity for our elderly, we would not have, we would not have in every community. I mean, the town I live in is tiny, and yet we've got an old people's warehouse here.
Yeah.
Nursing home? Bullshit. It's an old people's warehouse.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's horrible. And I will put a bullet through my head before I will ever go to one.
Right.
To the extent that I've got enough brains to do it, or don't die first.
Right. Well, my mother feels the same way, and she's still in the home that she's had since my father came back from World War II, and she won't leave, and that's okay, because I agree.
Yeah.
I agree with that.
My mother didn't go to one, and my father didn't go to one.
Right.
And
well, I think, that's the way most people do pass away. They pass away in their own homes, which is, I think, a good way to.
But you know what? You're right. Other cultures reverence their elderly far more than the United States does.
Right.
Because the elderly have become a revenue source, because nursing homes sprang up, because Medicare was willing to pay at one point for nursing home care, and still does to a certain extent. But by the same token, they will not pay a family. They will not pay for a family to have the things that it needs to keep a beloved family member in the home.
Right.
Now that, you know, and if you want an answer to why that is, that's because the right wing will take any social program that we create and try to figure out a way to make a fast buck off of it, and then turn around and talk family values out the other side of their mouths.
You got that so right. It's all about exploiting and abusing.
See, my problem thinking about leaving the country, Andy, is that I don't have the skills that Ike has. I don't, you know, I'm not an engineer. I'm not a scientist. I guess my best bet would be to go somewhere where I can teach people, where they want to learn to speak English. Or, I don't know, maybe go to India and be a supervisor in a call center. Wouldn't that just be wrong? But go some, you know, is Robert in Japan listening? You got any openings there at the university, Robert? because that's about all I can do is work with the language.
Right. It's not easy to do that, but it's always an alternative. Now, one other thing I wanted to bring up. There was an article a couple of days ago in the Financial Times. It's called U.S. Public Far Less Trusting of Business. Did you hear about that or anything?
No.
You talked about American exceptionalism, and I saw this, and this blew my mind. I don't hear anybody talking about this in the press, but we're outstanding in this recent study that was done. Here's some of the statistics. Just 46% of Americans last year in 2010 said they trusted business. That's down 8 points. In the rest of the world, it's up 2 points that they trust business, but we're down 8, right? It also says there's a backlash against bankers, and I wish Obama would jump on this. Americans who trust U.S. banks dropped to a low of only 25% from 33% a year ago and 71% before the financial crisis. So we are so distrusting of banks, it's ridiculous. We're down to 1/4 of the people trusting banks from 71%. This is incredible. And it says the U.S. is unique. We're the only country that in every category they tested, we're showing increased mistrust of government, non-governmental organizations, business, and the media. All the other countries polled showed increases of trust. Ours is down.
Oddly enough, some of that's teabaggers.
Where's the revolution?
Yeah. Hey, I just got an email in from Sandra. She said, ask Andy about the restructuring of the GSEs. You being a bit of a financial expert.
The restructuring of what, Fannie and Freddie?
The GSEs. Maybe I need further definition. So stick around and listen and shoot me an email once we figure out what that is.
Yeah, I think she's referring to Fannie and Freddie. And I just noticed there was an article about them today that they're trying to cut the dividend to the government. But the thing about Fannie and Freddie, you know, both of those, well, one came after the other by, I think, 20 years or something like that. But they were set up originally, I think Fannie was set up after the Great Depression to boost the housing market. So it's a necessary evil because they noticed that the private sector can't boost housing. It just does not have the capital to do it, and the power of low interest rates and taxing being part of the government, Fannie could get low interest capital out to people. So it was an efficient way to boost the housing industry and put roofs under people. So it's a necessary evil. I think we went wrong when we actually made them public entities. And here's Rahm Emanuel. Do you know Rahm Emanuel was on either Fannie or Freddie's board at a time? I think it was actually Fannie. But he was a board member. I mean, this is a total giveaway, you know, to some elitist to put them on the board of Fannie or Freddie. And anybody who gets, like, Franklin Raines, and there's another guy, I think, named Johnson, they're all hacks. They are just complete hacks. But they should not be public, and they should not be issuing stock. They should have been kept an agency, a special agency of the government, and their function to be to just increase housing and put roofs over people and not to have them. As soon as they became a public entity and issued stock and did stock options and made Franklin Raines these millionaires, you know, taking tens and 20 millions of dollars in salary, that's when Fannie and Freddie went under. And had all kind of problems when they made them public entities. They never should have been public. They always should have had big regulation watching what they've done, had a narrow mandate.
Strapped down and tightly managed along very, right. Very narrow purposing.
Right. Different from what the Republicans wanted. You know, Republicans have always wanted to privatize that and go, and they never got fully there. But once you privatize, that's when you lose control. And the entity starts trying to compete in the private sector. And that's not what it was supposed to be about. It was supposed to be, you know, a government function to help people, you know, in their lives and to have a decent place to live and an affordable home. Anyway, that's my thing on the GSEs. It never should have been privatized and moved away from being a government highly regulated agency. That was the wrong direction. I don't think Roosevelt and the people that did the New Deal ever wanted that to occur either.
No.
With Andy or Freddie.
Nope. Well, Andy, thank you very kindly, and I hope you have a good evening.
All right. Hey, thanks a lot, Bob. Thanks for the time. And
my pleasure.
Great listen to the show, and thanks for the sacrifice you make every night.
Oh, there's no sacrifice involved here. I'd be out screaming at clouds if I wasn't doing this.
You do a great service to your listeners, more so than you'll probably ever know. We really appreciate you. Take care.
Thank you, Andy. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
And let's see. Keep things going. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello, Bob. How you doing today? This is Haven.
Hey, Haven. How are you? Good to hear from you.
I'm doing all right. Yeah. Long time no call in, but I've been listening in and that sort of thing. I'm wondering if you have heard anything lately as far as has any Republican come out and taken credit for the unrest or revolutions going on in North Africa and elsewhere in the Muslim world?
I haven't seen that specifically, Haven, but I can tell you this much. What I said earlier to Andy about us being so good at getting these things wrong,
right.
Guess who put the word out early on to stand staunchly and stolidly and stridently beside Mubarak in Egypt? The United States Chamber of Commerce. They issued orders to the leader of their AmCham in Egypt to lend comfort and support to Hosni Mubarak. See? We're going to get it wrong real good again.
Yeah, that's expected. That's expected. I mean, and not only that, but listening to some of the coverage and looking over, you know, looking up some stuff myself, Tunisia, he was our man in Tunisia, the guy who just fled there. Yemen, of course, in WikiLeaks, the guy, the I guess you would say president of Yemen, he was a supporter of the drone attacks against his own people, as they
right.
say. Yeah. It, I mean, it's amazing. Well, it's not really, actually, it's not even amazing anymore. But, I mean, we always support these lunatics. Because I guess they'll do what...
Because they protect our money. See, that's like exactly. the Yemeni guy who supported the drone attacks on his own people. Well, his own people that the drone attacks were being done on were people who wanted to, theoretically at least, separate his head from his shoulders. Because he's a thug. He's been there for 25 years. You know, once you get that far down the road, you're staying in power not by virtue of your benevolence, but by virtue of your heavy-handedness. Because sooner or later, a political leader can't help but wear out his welcome. And
definitely.
And it is like what Hillary Clinton said when through improved communications and information exchange, people find out that the vast wealth of their country is being pocketed by a very few people. They get upset about it unless they're the United States, in which case we have an entire political party whose whole philosophy is dedicated to saying, well, that's what God wants, and it's Americanism and exceptionalism and capitalism, and that's the way it ought to be.
Well, that's true, but I mean, that's more the other term, the inside the beltway, the beltway consensus, I guess it's what it's called, where, you know, anyone, you know, regardless of the president, you notice how the State Department and I guess different others in the government were really kind of scratching their head trying to figure out what to say about Egypt. I think they're still trying to figure out what to say about what's going on in Egypt.
Well, I think they are, because if you are willing to credit, and some aren't, some are, if you're willing to credit a good, decent democratic impulse to Barack Obama, then you really do feel like you're in a corner. Because you've got a whole lot of American business interests saying, we got to protect the money over there, Barack. And on the other hand, you've got Barack Obama saying, yeah, but the people want freedom. Because one of the things that I did hear in scanning the coverage today, Haven, was people saying, well, you know, this is not an Islamist movement. This is secular people. This is religious people. People of varying stripes in between, saying they're just tired. They're tired of the repression. They're tired of the dictatorship, and they want a real taste of freedom.
I heard that too.
The minute I heard that, I became a little bit curious as to what, because once the for-profit media have uttered it, I become suspicious of it. I haven't seen any overarching indications that there is any religious fundamentalism in it, but it's almost hard to pretend that something like that would take place in a place like Egypt without the religious fundamentalists being involved somewhere in it, because A, Hosni Mubarak has gone a long way toward creating the radicalism that in turn plagues him and plagues us. Remember, Hosni Mubarak helped create, what's the guy's name? He was a surgeon, for God's sakes. A surgeon, Haven. He was a physician.
Right.
But because of the repressive tendencies of the Mubarak regime, they managed to turn a man named Ayman al-Zawahiri from a freaking doctor into a radical, what they like to call a radical jihadist. How much of that is believable? How much of that is CIA disinformation? You know, God only knows.
Who knows? Yeah. But you know, they were saying that, you know, of course, before the start of the war in Iraq, they were saying that knocking over Saddam's regime would start basically this domino effect of knocking out the tyrants throughout the Middle East. Now, number one, of course, that was pretty much bogus, because most of those tyrants were placed there by the U.S. in the first place, so why would they want to knock those over? But, you know, in a predictable kind of way, I'm expecting, I'm doing a countdown, waiting for whoever is shilling for Bush this month to show up and say, well, we told you so. This was all a part of our plan. Even as their investments get burnt up in Egypt and in Yemen and over in Tunisia and maybe even Jordan. I mean, Jordan is supposed to be in our pocket, you know?
Right. Exactly.
And they're sweating all that out. Oh, and another thing. Has anybody heard from Osama bin Laden? It would seem like.
Well, remember, we had an audio postcard from Osama just last week.
Really, I missed that.
Oh, absolutely. And he said he was going to attack the French.
Okay. Oh, I missed that too. Well, that's the next logical step: Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, France.
See, they're stair-stepping their way toward the next thing. You know, they'll I've got one of those right-wing press blather releases here today. You're going to love this, Haven. From something that calls itself the Blue Collar Corner, because you know, blue collar working people, they're Republicans, because Republicans is a looking out for them. From the Blue Collar Corner, way cleared for taxpayers' money to fund Ground Zero Mosque. Really?
Oh, okay.
You know, the mosque that isn't a mosque, that isn't at Ground Zero, that's not a mosque. Right. And well, you and I, we're going to build it. And, you know, if I ever had one of these clowns on the show, Haven, I'd say, well, you know, well, why not? We built it. We helped build a Taj Mahal for Jerry Jones, you know, down in Dallas.
Yep.
Well, the people of Kentucky are getting ready to build an ark extravaganza for the right-wing fundamentalists who believe that the earth is slightly younger than the written recipe for beer and bread. I guess aliens wrote those recipes, because, you know, human beings haven't been here that long. We were created, and there was the recipe, and we had the beer and the bread, and everything's been good since.
And don't forget,
so why not taxpayer fund a mosque? Let's be all equal about this.
Mm-hmm.
Jesus.
I don't know. Oh, and you mentioned right to work laws.
Yes.
Before, yeah. We have Republicans in the House and the Senate. They run the House and the Senate in North Carolina, and they have this this first 100 days list, and of course North Carolina is a right to work state, and yet number two on the list is fighting to protect jobs by keeping our right to work laws. As if,
well, if that doesn't just make you want to stick your foot in a bucket and start singing, I don't know what. We're going to protect our jobs by creating by making it easier to pay people less, so they'll the that's a special kind of crazy that it has to take a Republican to comprehend. But how long's that? This is the first Republican legislature in North Carolina since when?
Probably in my lifetime.
I think I saw an email that it was the first Republican Republican legislature in North Carolina since the Greensboro trials.
Oh.
Maybe I've got that wrong.
That wouldn't surprise me.
Or maybe one of the houses or whatever. And you know, that same kind of thing went on in Alabama. Our buddy Matt Osborne at OsborneInc.com is trying to raise money for something he's calling the Goat Hill Project. Alabama's legislature, as weird as Alabama has been in the last generation, two generations, well, three, no, four, wait, as weird as Alabama politics is, for this November election created Republican majorities in both houses of the Alabama legislature for the first time since Reconstruction. Can you imagine that?
Wow.
I mean, it is gonna be a, it's gonna be a circus act, with elephants and clowns and jugglers and fire eaters and sword swallowers and everything.
I bet their list looks a lot like our list.
I'll bet it does too. And I'll bet it includes things like, returning the calculation of pi to a more god, to a more godly round number. you remember it, and see, yeah. now they've got the power to do it. You may remember, what was it, 4 or 5 years ago, this one right-wing POS from Tuscaloosa introduced a bill to defund every defund any library in the state of Alabama that had books authored by or about Homer sectionals.
Mm.
Well, now they've got the majority to pass that.
Mm.
Because, you know, see, that's going to wipe out Shakespeare. It's going to wipe out, the King James Bible, because it was translated by a bunch of gay guys. But to be a fly on the wall in Montgomery on Goat Hill, that could be some big fun. And it sounds like there's some big fun, maybe, and fun, I mean, in a sort of, tragic self-inflicted kind of way to watch that stuff shake out.
Yeah, I'm trying to pay more attention to North Carolina politics, but we don't have anything in North Carolina. We have something that's kind of, we have left-wing stations, but they pull in their programming. You know, they play Tom Hartman, but we don't have anybody actually in our state that covers our state with any kind of real shameless left-leaning
liberalism.
Right.
See, that goes to the heart of something that I said a couple of nights ago about building infrastructure. Everybody doesn't need to be a national talk host. You need people actually on the ground who are able to build nice lives for themselves and their families in Raleigh-Durham, who do liberal talk on the radio about North Carolina. You need a liberal talker in Birmingham, Alabama. You need a liberal talker who does Georgia politics in Atlanta. You need a liberal talker who does Tennessee politics in Nashville. And that's one element of the infrastructure that we have not built in this country.
Yep, that's true.
Because the moneyed liberals won't put the money up for it.
And there are several right-wing, local right-wing talkers. I mean, all across the state. You travel from one end of the state to the other. They're dotted all over the place, but not the left wing. They're here. There are plenty of left-wingers here.
And I'll bet some of them would be great behind a microphone.
Yeah, yeah.
But see, inherent in that is a little bit of snobbery. And that's why I hammer on it every chance I get. It is important, you see, Haven, that there's a Haven in North Carolina calling this program. It is important that there's a David in Tennessee and a Luke in Tennessee and a David in South Carolina and a Jack in Louisiana and listeners in Alabama like our buddy Burns and folks, our buddy Dennis in Kentucky and Tobias in Kentucky. It's important that Ron in Raleigh there, one of your North Carolina compatriots, Haven.
Yep, yep.
It's important that we have them on the air being liberal, not so much for right-wing lurkers, but so that the people who walk with their noses so far in the air that the air just blows straight in like jet intakes, who think that there's no liberalism left in the South, those are the people who need to hear you. Because I know what it's like to live and grow up behind the cornbread curtain. And as David in South Carolina's pointed out so many times, Haven, it can get a little hot.
Oh, yeah.
Just to be liberal. And those stories... And the dedication to purpose and concept and people that comes with being a Southern liberal needs to be heard by people who think there aren't any liberals in the South. because they desperately need that little bit of wake up. And because somewhere along the way, maybe dot connects to dot connects to dot, and we finally figure out that the South is worth it. The South is worth our efforts. That you, Haven, and all the other Southern listeners to the Horn are worth it. You know what I mean?
Definitely. Definitely. You have no idea how many, there's a place that I work, and you would not believe how many scientists there are who think global warming is a crock. And they're here in the South. They're in Research Triangle Park. It amazes me. I can't argue with these people. I don't have a science degree. But I mean, I read.
You're breathing in and breathing out. You've got a functioning brain.
Right. Yeah.
Well, never doubt for a minute, Haven. To coin your own name. In many ways, this program was designed as a haven, so that Southern liberals could do the Horton Hears a Who kind of thing and go, "We're here. We're here."
Right.
Well, it's awfully good to hear from you. Don't be such a stranger, all right?
Okay. Oh, one last thing.
Yes.
The N-word. And this was a few weeks ago about the changing of the words in...
Huckleberry Finn.
Huckleberry Finn, yeah. Thank you. There is a word that we use. There are a couple of words that we use that are foul. They're pretty foul. They have a foul history, at least. And I've been meaning to call in about this.
Okay.
I have a dictionary from 1968. I found it in a thrift store, and I had to buy it because Google does not, it's incomplete. And the word ethnic is in Webster's dictionary. This word meant pretty much the same thing as nigger. And ignorant, foreigner, heathen, barbarian comes from the Greek word ethnikos.
Mm-hmm.
That's like the
code when the right winger talks about, well, you know, that Barack Obama, he's terribly, terribly urban.
Yeah.
You know, I'd just as soon they use the word that they're thinking about instead of the word that they write. Because then at least we'd have a clear line drawn, and we'd know who's about what. Oh, he's urban, and that stuff started in radio, Haven, because rather than coming up with a black music chart, Radio and Records or Variety or whomever or Billboard created the urban chart. What does that mean? That only people who live in cities listen to it? Because that's what urban means, city people. But but we all understand what urban means and what ethnic means. That goes back to the roots of rock and roll, when there were things that proper upstanding Leave It to Beaver white families, warden June Cleavers were shocked to find out that they were shocked to find out that Wally and the Beaver were listening to that race music. Race music. The white culture in this country works really, really hard, not only to eliminate black culture from America, but when they have to talk about it, to make sure that they can code word around it. And some of them didn't.
Well,
some of the ones with the sheets and pillows. I don't want my little Mayella listening to that music.
Well, to be fair to white culture, there are black folks who do not want to be identified with black or blackness or Afro or African and that sort of thing. And, you know, they definitely endorse coming up with words that make us more part of that mainstream America that they wish, that certain kind of America, I should say, that they wish we should, they think we should be a part of. You know, so they're trying to strip the race out of things. And that's what, at least that's what it seems like.
Well, it's to ignore the role of race in America, I think, is to set up a situation in which you can't talk about America. You just can't.
For sure.
Haven, have a great night, my friend.
You too.
All right, bye now. Calling from North Carolina, that's our buddy Haven. And onward we go. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, howdy, Bob. Hey, yeah, this is David out in San Francisco.
Oh, thanks for calling. It was nice talking to you after the show last night.
Yeah, I heard you running through all the Davids, so I figured I better put
Yeah, I forgot. We got a West Coast David, too.
Yeah.
We've got a David fraternity here.
There you go. Hey, you know, I was interested in your last conversation there. You were talking about education. You're familiar with Malthus, or is it Malthus?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, and Malthusian philosophy is that in which if the population gets too big, then it's doomed to collapse and all this sort of junk.
And a big die-off, yes.
Yeah, Malthus is admired by the fat cats who generally loot nations. So, you know, if you look at the current neocons, they're real adherents of Malthus, where if they're going to loot the country, it's to their advantage to have us all homeless and dead before we figure it out, and, you know, fighting among ourselves rather than going after the big guys. So the old standard of Malthusian economics is that don't educate anybody. Let supply and demand create food prices so high that everybody starves quick. And, you know, make sure there's no health care to take care of anybody. And so as you were talking about, you know, liberalism in the South or education in the South, I think that the policymakers in the South have known this forever. And, in fact, they've probably known it, well, they've obviously known it before the Civil War, because Malthus died in the early 1800s. But the idea that, for example, I'm a big Ralph Nader supporter, and Nader has talked a lot about how the people of the South essentially got conned by the fat cats, since slaves were owned by only the real rich. It was, I think, 85% of the slaves were owned by major corporations, and in the South, very few people had more than, or very few people had one slave or anything like that.
Well, the vast majority of the Southern forces that fought the Civil War, David, were not slave owners.
Right, right.
And the funny thing is, the moneyed class still rides on that. That's why they were able to say, when they celebrated the secession of South Carolina from the Union last month, well, this ain't a celebration of slavery. This here is a celebration of states' rights and our willingness to stand up for ourselves.
Right. And it's kind of interesting because it's, you know, the idea of states' rights was that you would have the right to do whatever you wanted in that state, and as long as it didn't have anything to do with interstate commerce, it couldn't be controlled from Washington, D.C. And so if one state decided to have slavery or, you know, con artists ruling the roost, then that's up to the, you know, the population to put up with. And, you know, obviously the idea that united you stand, divided you fall was the principle that got us away from being the subjects of kings and tyrants. The idea that why would we be dumb enough to put up with having local kings and tyrants that couldn't be controlled from anywhere else, much less from our brothers across the state line. And so the idea that that they still continue to try to pull that same con, and, you know, with the current subprime scandal, for example, all of the 8 million people who are projected to become homeless this year because of the looting of the mortgages and whatnot, you know, the idea that somebody could rob you across a state line, you know, New York making a colony of Georgia or New York making a colony of Alabama, obviously that's still a hot button issue in the South. But why in the world would anybody in Alabama admire these same subprime scammers who are looting Georgia, Alabama, Florida, you know, the South? It's as if their states' rights argument is turned on its head because they admire the very con artists that are making you know, pudding out of their local economy, creating a worse and worse economics that you know, just seems to spiral downward, which is the reason why I brought up the Malthus business. Malthus, Robert Malthus, went out of his way to make sure that he advocated making sure that the poor died quickly, because if you let them linger, they're gonna do anything they can to fight back, or their corpses are gonna be in the way of progress, or something like that. So it's a really sick philosophy, and apparently there are plenty of people that still live by it. And you know, looking at you know, the current Supreme Court, you know, I don't know if you've been keeping up with you know, going after Scalia and Clarence Thomas, but
well, I have been, and I've, in fact, I was among the very first back when Citizens United broke a year ago, David, to suggest, back when we still had the House, and of course we squandered the opportunity. When Citizens United first broke, I was among the first, if not the very first, to suggest that an impeachment hearings should begin immediately with regard to Alito and Roberts, because of the fact that they perjured themselves in their confirmation testimony. But now what we find out is that, yeah, okay, those two are perjurers, and Scalia and Thomas are just dirty, bought-off so-and-sos in the pay of the Koch brothers.
Absolutely, yeah. By the way, I heard today that there was a third one brought in. Is it Roberts that's the third?
I'm not sure, offhand.
Yeah, I not online right quick, you know, to be able to check. But someone told me that there's now a third name, and that it would make sense that it was Roberts, because, you know, that guy is about as dirty as you could get. Those, you know, the Supreme Court just, it's kind of interesting, because, you know, in religion, Martin Luther, the famous old Martin Luther that created the Lutheran religion, you know, he was a Catholic monk, and he discovered corruption in the church, and he listed all of these corrupt practices that the Catholic...
his theses on the church door.
Yeah, he nailed it to the door, right. And one of them that was the most pronounced was the,
selling of indulgences?
Indulgences, exactly. That was something that Bush was doing. The idea that Blackwater could be exempted from murder. The idea that you could pay now, sin later. The technical philosophy of indulgences was pay now, sin later. You could do a prepay plan for sinning.
Well, yeah, and remember, the entirety of the Crusades was recruited that way, because one could get expiation for one's earthly sins by going and dying, killing infidels in the Holy Land. How much difference is there, David, between that and Blackwater?
Not a bit. And so the whole concept of political contributions is exactly that. And you know, as they talk about, you know, how did the Germans, how were they so stupid that they had mass, you know, concentration camps just up the road, and they never noticed it, or they never did anything about it? Well, it was this sort of same philosophy that said that, you know, the hierarchy is always right, and that the average person is always wrong. The idea of doing budget cuts for the schools at a very time when people have been looted in such a pronounced way that you know, if I keep calling up radio talk shows, especially when they've got school board members on them, and raising the issue of having economics as a you know, training little kids in economics, fifth grade, you know, before junior high, training kids in economics. And if you were to do that at an early age, you could make sure they wouldn't get looted. But I'm in my 50s, and I've seen, you know, the looting of the during Jimmy Carter's term. There was the massive farm losses. People were losing their farms. Then all during Reagan, the same thing happened. Three quarters of American farms went under during Reagan-Bush. Then, you know, the savings and loans crooks took a huge piece out of us. Then, you know, we've got the current subprime. So just in my lifetime, there have been three massive lootings which have taken massive amounts of land away from the middle class. So since the school districts are paid for by landowners, typically it's property taxes that pay for school districts, when you take that much money out of that much land holding out of the average person's hands, and then you put it over into the rich, who have no loyalty to America, their loyalty is to the god of mammon and making more money. And by God, sure, here we are right now where they want tax breaks. And Bush was, many people don't even remember it, but Bush actually gave tax breaks all the way back to 1988. You know, Bush was elected, or so-called elected, in 2000, but he gave some of the biggest corporations in America tax breaks all the way back to 88, which is also going into one of the Martin Luther precepts that you can absolve someone of sins. You know, you can take away their past debt and you know, reimburse them.
So, well, you know, what's kind of interesting though in what you described, David, is that it also embraces another biblical concept. That being the concept of Jubilee, the periodic remission of debt. But the thing is, the way it works out in a neo-Calvinist light is that Jubilee is something that only the corporate oligarchs get. Because that's what it was. It was literally, the George W. Bush administration was a corporate Jubilee within its strict biblical sense of the word. And you've got Republicans to this day hollering about, I heard it just the other day, our corporate tax rates have got to be, our corporate tax rates are higher than Canada's and Ireland's and the whole wide world's got lower corporate tax rates, and that's why we can't compete.
Yeah, well, those guys are the biggest welfare cheats there are. It's kind of interesting, too, you know, just looking at, you know, the energy. By the way, I'm a real advocate of Jubilee. You know, I don't know if I've got your email address, but I created some alternative currency based on Howard Zinn.
Yes, the Zinnia. We've talked about it.
Yeah, did I send some of them to you?
Yes, you did.
Oh, okay, good. Because, you know, feel free to put them on, you know, some website or another. Those are based on ours. You know, so there's a 1, a 2, and a 5 Zinnia. And so people can just trade ours. You know, whether you're babysitting or doing legal services, you can trade an hour for an hour. And the idea that essentially the fraud of the economic world is that the currency can be manipulated so that a dollar is no longer worth what you remember it as. The value is changed on a regular basis. Well, in the case of a zinnia, an hour is an hour, and the only way it cannot work is if your watch is broken. And the idea that if we're being told that we have to believe some kind of a currency that's based upon some sort of a number that changes every day, we don't need to believe that. We can go to an alternative currency that's based upon time and get projects done, whether it's fixing the back steps or getting the groceries delivered or, you know, some other errand around town. Since most of our lives are based upon local events, local currencies are very available for making sure that, you know, 70-80% of what we need done in a given day gets taken care of solely by our own arrangements. I lived in Colorado during the 80s when there was a horrible depression out there, and the people that survived the best were the ones that were bartering. And they actually, I was eating like a king, because I was bartering basically food, you know, and I was eating some of the best quality stuff. It was amazing. Getting fat in Colorado in those days was a tough thing to do, but I was doing it. And I never paid a nickel's rent for 6.5 years because I was doing work for rent arrangements with landlords. It was amazing. There was one year where my taxable income was actually $1,200 for the entire year, $100 a month. But I was living like a king, and it was great. I had 20 acres and a great big house with all sorts of solar features. And
oh, cool.
Great way of living. But, yeah, anyway.
You mentioned a house with solar features and stuff. That takes me back to this ongoing dream I have for the horn here, Dave. And that is to be able to say at the beginning and end of every broadcast, no mountains were harmed in the making of this radio.
Sure.
Somewhere along the way, I hope someday that we put up small scale wind turbines and solar, so that we're completely off the grid with this program. We buy renewable energy credits, but that doesn't mean that they're going to blow up any fewer mountains. I got to get this program off the grid.
Sure. Well, you know, have you ever heard of the Solar Living Institute?
Yes.
Yeah, they're out here in California, up in Northern California. I wonder if they need like an East Coast or a Southern, exposure, so to speak. I wonder if you could contact them and maybe they could send you some display models so that if people in your section of the country wanted to see a working operation, they could come down to the station and see how a station could be operated with solar.
Well, I've just pulled up the website. I'm going to make contact with them because one of the biggest things that would put a boulder sized pebble in the shoe of Big Coal would be to have an operation that was completely off the grid and well publicized.
Sure.
You know, we ain't blowing no mountains up, and we're feeling real good about it. We're not poisoning anybody's water. You know, the sun and because the big rap around here is. The more conciliatory of the coal thugs in Appalachia, David, will say, well, that wind and solar may be great somewheres down the road, but see, right now it can't provide baseload power.
Which is the big lie.
Which is a giant lie.
Yeah, I mean, Albert Einstein knew that you cannot create energy without taking a loss. It's only a matter of how much loss you're going to do, and so in the case of coal, if I remember right, I took a photovoltaics course some years ago, and in the late 80s, it was costing 45 cents a kilowatt hour, a megawatt hour, to produce. No, it was a kilowatt hour, 45 cents a kilowatt hour. And if you look on your meter you look on your bill, I don't know what you're paying down there. Is it probably 8 cents to 11 cents a kilowatt hour? It's truly costing you 45 cents, or it's costing 45 cents. They get these huge tax breaks from our April 15th taxes to pay for the railroad, to pay for the black lung, to pay for remediation costs.
Right, the externalized cost that coal gets away with.
Yeah, exactly. And so it's like 35 cents of your taxes on April 15th are paying your electric bill and you don't know it. In terms of solar, it's costing you, it truly costs 17 cents to produce. So if, to produce electricity. So if we're currently paying 8 to 11 cents a kilowatt hour, we could save the national budget by just going straight over to solar, and we'd only have to pay that extra 6 cents or so.
Well, and see, individual home-based solar scares the living bejesus out of the power companies. You know, great big outfits like the Southern Company and American Electric Power, of whom a subsidiary is Appalachian Power, which is my power company. It scares the bejesus out of them, the idea that people would put solar panels on their homes, and that's why there's no active subsidization for it coming out of the federal government when there really ought to be. Because an America that doesn't need a power company, well, that's, you know, again, that's not good for some of those fat cats.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, that's the whole fraud of this thing. These guys have been on these welfare programs for you know, a century or more. And the idea that we don't notice that extra 35 cents per kilowatt hour coming out of our income taxes.
See, that's one of the things that drives me nuts about the State of the Union the other night, David, was to, you know, there was that great line that Barack Obama delivered about, you know, let's end the welfare subsidies to the oil industry. I don't know if you've noticed, but they seem to be doing okay as it is.
Right.
That was great, but then, what, 2-3 minutes later, he mentioned clean coal technology?
What a liar, yeah. Profoundly stupid, yeah. It's unbelievable to me to... You wonder who's whispering in his ear. Is his speech written by a whole bunch of other people and he didn't read it ahead of time? That clean coal phrase has been, you know, laughed at before Election Day to, you know, 2008. And the idea that that guy would be so stupid as to continue to use that phrase is, I mean, I'm so sick of Obama. The idea that global warming is still not getting budgeted for and that, you know, I've lived...
Well, hell, my senator was just elected to the Senate off the back of a TV ad in which he used a rifle,
right,
to shoot fired a rifle into something that was called cap and trade deal.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, if you keep up with Nader, his take on cap and trade was it's also a scam, but it's not the same version of a scam that the right wingers look at it. To me, and, you know, to the Nader tapes, the idea of cap and trade is that you're bartering on the lifeblood of the planet. And the idea that you could drain the oil, for example, out of underneath the earth and then think that you're not going to create earthquakes when you create a huge series of caves underneath there. The idea that you're not going to have some externalized damage when you take you take a liquid and you turn it into a gas and you don't do anything to plant new trees to turn that gas back into into other types of gases. The idea that these guys are creating these false series of Wall Street deals to be able to continue polluting, but then I don't know if you knew it, but the original way that they scammed the economy when they first did NAFTA was they were claiming that the Canadian, U.S., and Mexican trade deals was going to create a huge economy that was going to stabilize the world. And even though you had an exchange rate with Canada that was different than the U.S. dollar and the Mexican peso was completely different, there was some promise that in the future it was going to make a stable economy for all three countries in the northern U.S. hemisphere. The idea that first didn't happen, but these guys were able to create huge business deals, but still abusing those currency exchange rates. So say, for example, when with cap and trade, they say, well, I can pollute in North Dakota, but if I do some remediation in Canada, that'll be all right because, you know, we'll plant some more forests in Canada. Well, if there's an exchange rate between the Canadian dollar and the U.S. dollar, and that fluctuates just this amount, but you've done a 20-year deal, you can take advantage of those exchange rates and never have to do any cleanup, never have to do any remediation because you've taken advantage of the exchange rate. Well, if the peso goes jumping a lot more than the Canadian dollar, then you can actually do more pollution and pretend that you've done more remediation just because you've fluctuated the peso. Well, it was bad enough when they only had NAFTA, but then they added GATT, and GATT added a whole bunch more countries with a whole bunch more currencies that you could fluctuate. And so then they were able to do endless fluctuation with more pollution and less remediation because of the currency exchange rates. Then they added Africa, and they've added Southeast Asia, and they've added all these other countries of the world, and now they're just playing one currency against another and never doing anything to clean up. So it's this huge fraud. Cap and trade is not only a gambling debt for it's a casino for pretend remediation for pollution, but it's also this scam that the neocons, the little guy never gets to take part in it. The big guys don't want to tell anybody about what they're really doing, and that gets back to the original point about having economics in grade school, because the little kids better get started in grade school figuring this stuff out, or they are going to be screwed by the time, you know, their dad gets evicted.
And, David, that reminds me, I mean, there are people I know who, there's a guy I know, I grew up with him, graduated high school a year behind him. You talk about the kids, and I can't help but mention his name, because if you're ever anywhere near where he's doing his work, you got to see the show. His performance name is Steve Trash, Rockin' okay. Eco Warrior.
Okay.
And he's a magician. And he does stuff, he does kids' magic with garbage, all with an eye toward teaching children the values of recycling. And of being more aware of where stuff comes from and how stuff gets to them. And if we had a bunch of him going into every school in the country, we'd be a long way toward what you're talking about.
Hey, you know, how close are you to Tuskegee?
Well, I mean, I'm in West Virginia.
Well, is that like 200 miles from you or whatever?
Oh, golly, Ned, no, it's more like 700.
Oh, that far? Okay. Well, the reason I ask, George Washington Carver, when he was inventing all of those things out of the peanut and the soybean,
the sweet potato.
Well, yeah. Well, the thing that he was doing that was most significant, a lot of people don't think of him as an economist, but he was really doing that specifically because he was inventing all of those things from the soybean and the peanut and the sweet potato in order to give a small business a boost, or, you know, the average man a boost, because essentially, you know, the whole problem of King Cotton and just ruining the soil with these corporate farms and plantations, what Carver was doing was, when people got trapped with the tenant-farmer arrangements, you know, they were generally growing corn or wheat or some kind of a grain.
Cotton.
Cotton too, but it's something that could be fluctuated in the Commodities Trade Board up in Chicago or whatnot, and that even if they started the year off thinking they were going to get a good price for it, when it came time to harvest, well, all of a sudden the price drops, they're going to lose money, they're going to end their, you know, owning their own, selling their soul to the company store. So what Carver did was he invented all of these different things. For example, with soybeans you could make ink, you could make different kinds of plastic. And with a quarter acre of soybeans, if you had the formulas for making ink and you knew some printer down the way that needed a bunch of ink, with a quarter acre of soybeans, you could make enough ink to pay.
And everything that Carver did, he did not treat as being proprietary. You could make the argument that George Washington Carver was the father of open sourcing.
Exactly, yeah. Well, he also knew he'd get shot or somebody would take his patents and lock them away, so he open-sourced them so they would get used. And at this point, I've been looking for many of those formulas. People tell me they're in Springfield, Missouri. They tell me they're in Ames, Iowa. They tell me they're down in Tuskegee, but they are somewhere. And I've found it very difficult to find those exact formulas. But say, for example, those little plastic bags, when you go to the grocery and you want to get various things in the vegetable aisle or whatnot, those plastic bags will last for 300 years. Well, Carver had invented some plastics that would break down in a week's time.
You remind me of something that hit the shipping industry 10-15 years ago, David, and that is, and I don't know if it ever actually got anywhere, but you know the styro popcorn that
right.
Somebody invented invented styrofoam that was made of cornstarch.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And it dissolved in water.
Yeah, yeah. We see that out here. California is really quickly becoming green, and that's actually becoming pretty popular out here. And that's exactly right. The only trouble with you know, using it from a food product is that, you know, if you do too much corn production of something like that, then, you know, you'll actually have starvation.
Oh, absolutely. And you remind me of something that I wanted to make sure and mention on the program this evening. On Twitter, I follow our buddy Angelo, who tweets under the handle Stop Beck. And it was sort of a bad news kind of thing because Glenn Beck has lost practically all of his advertisers. But guess who signed on to start advertising with him, David? Monsanto.
The devil joins his crew, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I tweeted back at him. I said, you know, suddenly I hate high fructose corn syrup even more. Because what you said about using corn like that too much is that you contribute to famine. Well, that's what has happened in the American Midwest. Places that used to grow corn for human consumption or any a wide variety of other other edible produce goods now grow Monsanto Roundup Ready number 2 field grade corn.
Right.
And I don't know what you know or don't know about it, David, but you can boil it, you can roast it, you can toast it, you can bake it, you can do anything under the sun to it, but the one thing you as a human being cannot do is eat it.
Right.
You can't eat it. The only thing it's good for is animal feed at these confined animal feed operations, CAFOs, these horrible cow schwitzes.
Right.
And the other thing you can do to it is take it to a proprietary fracking facility, just like they frack hydrocarbons, they frack corn, and they frack it into high fructose corn syrup, which is part and parcel of the massive nationwide diabetes epidemic, pandemic that plagues us to this day.
Right. That gets back to Malthus, you know, the idea that starve them quick so that they don't complain. You know, you kill a vast amount of them before they ever notice it. Yeah.
Well, exactly, and we have come full circle, and I do have to roll on, but it's been a great phone call and a great conversation. David, you take care, my friend.
Yeah, have a good week.
All right, you too. Bye now.
Yeah.
David, another member of the David fraternity, calling from the San Francisco area. One last call before we quit for the night. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hey, Bob, it's Preston.
Hey, Preston.
I would certainly I share David's affinity for Ralph Nader. Nader just had a article published on Common Dreams regarding antibiotics, and that's something we began to touch on last time I called, and the overuse of antibiotics. And yeah, he's doing some great work, continues to for sure. And I think it's a shame how liberals on the left and progressives were divided over, you know, him running for president, so the presidency again and all that stuff. I think the way we were focused on that Florida vote was very manipulative, how it was like, look, if he hadn't run, Gore would have gotten that, you know, how they framed the argument that
yeah,
way.
But see, I'm one of those that doesn't fall for that because I happen to live in West Virginia, Preston.
Okay.
And West Virginia had not voted for a Republican presidential candidate since God was a baby. But they did in 2000. Mm-hmm. And the margin of victory in the 2000 election was such that if West Virginia had done what West Virginia should have done and gone for Gore, then the 5 electoral votes that West Virginia had would have put Gore into the White House. And there would have been, and Florida, frankly, yeah, would not have mattered.
You know, there are so many different scenarios, you know, where things could have turned out differently, so. Yeah, and anyway, but I think he's, you know, he perseveres, and you know, there's a great documentary about him called An Unreasonable Man. And anyway, I received an article regarding mountaintop removal that caught my interest. Apparently they're doing a lot of, quote, development on that land and, you know, doing things like putting out driving ranges for golfers and stuff like that on what used to be mountaintops. And it was sad to see. You know, this is like a development, like a sprawl project in some ways. You know, blow up the mountains and make it more, you know, developer-friendly, I guess. Maldevelopment-friendly, I think. Are you aware of that, that kind of redevelopment?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
Yes, that kind of stuff fascinates me because the way that I tend to look at mountaintop removal is I look at that, I can't help but look at it for what it's doing to me and my communities, but I also look out into the wider into wider America and ask questions like, why is it necessary? You know, why does the rest of the country still contribute to the apocalypse that's taking place here, and how do they do it?
Mm-hmm. There's a pattern of thinking that helps it along. You know, our unthinking, or I don't know. Single focus thinking, kind of related to that neo-Calvinism you were talking about. Barbara Ehrenreich, in her book Bright-Sidedness, talks about some of the kind of cult-like thinking that goes on in the corporatist system, you know, which includes complete disregard for ecosystems and, you know, things of nature. You know, they're creating this kind of synthetic world in so many ways. Substituting their genetically engineered products and, you know, whatnot for, you know, clear-cut dams and stuff like that. And at every turn, they are blowing it up, poisoning it. It's a psychosis, really, a form of madness. And they get together in, like, sports stadiums and they hear Zig Ziglar and, I don't know, some general and John Elway or whoever go, yay team, and no negativity here, you know, just full steam ahead. This is
and never is heard a discouraging word and the skies are not cloudy all day.
And our stock's going up. But there is a flip side, and again, you know, thinking of the Ehrenreich bright-sidedness and how optimism can be problematic if it's, you know, too rosy, I guess. But just, you know, even if it's not successful, knowing that there are these alternatives out there, I think says something good about human nature that we can appreciate, even though, you know, who knows how successful it's going to be. Martin Luther King Jr. actually said something interesting. A Facebook friend passed along this quote, something like, even if you could convince me that the world was going to go to pieces tomorrow, I would still plant my apple tree. And he had been reading a lot of Thoreau and Emerson and Gandhi and people who, you know, talk about the satisfaction of kind of trying to do the right thing as you see it, however much time we have here on this earth. And additionally, I think if we have a clearer view of what's going on in the world, including the hard to look at sometimes injustices all over the place, regarding trade policies and wars and stuff like that, the north-south relationship between the hemispheres. I think, while we're here, we're more apt to be sympathetic, you know, to sharpen our instinct for empathy, like Obama suggested we try to do. That was a line from his recent, you know, his recent talks. I think the one after the Tucson shooting, actually, he said we could work on sharpening our instinct for empathy. And that's kind of a radical comment, again.
Oh, it is. And, of course, anytime you get a word like empathy, the right wing loses their minds.
Yeah,
or what passes for minds.
And pairing it with instinct. You know, again, the right wing militarists and their endless dominator propaganda is trying to tell us all the time that we're just violent and selfish and all that stuff. And, you know, that's part of us. But it's not all of us, and there are other parts of our being that, you know, we can try to bring to the fore a little bit here and there. You know, I think one problem, and I don't, you know, a lot of friends of mine have appreciated her work, but think that so many, and a lot of young people are introduced to, have easy access to Ayn Rand. And again, where does the selfishness come from? Well, she literally wrote the book, you know, The Virtue of Selfishness.
Yeah. And, but I do take comfort, Preston, in the fact that I mentioned it on the show a few days back, the fact that it turns out that for all her talk about selfishness and how government programs were bad and people who accessed government programs were looters and moochers, mm-hmm. you know, what sickening language that is. Well, you know, and now all of a sudden, I think six times in my inbox today, I've received from various people who probably haven't caught up with the podcast yet, the same story. That lo and behold, in 1974, when Ayn Rand was getting older and her husband was still with her, that they both, now of course she didn't sign up under Ayn Rand, because, well, you know, she was a dishonest old bat. But she and her husband signed up for both Medicare and Social Security.
There you go.
Because she suddenly realized that her earnings from her books, which were substantial, could not withstand catastrophic illness for both her and her husband. And that suddenly she needed that social safety net, and she didn't waste a minute going after it and looting and a mooching.
Mm-hmm. And you know, she spent a lot of money on her bling, like that brooch of a dollar sign that she liked to wear.
Oh yeah.
And where?
Oh, she was just a disgusting old hack.
Where did you find that article?
It's all over. Just do a quick search on any engine you prefer.
Okay.
Ayn Rand got Social Security.
Interesting, because I was just looking for, you know, some more critical articles. It's surprising. I mean, for the scope of impact, there needs to be a lot more critical material.
Right, and the way you respond now, now that this information is out there, and apparently it's been closely guarded, the way you respond to it now is whenever some right-winger says, Ayn Rand said, you mean Ayn Rand, the Social Security and Medicare recipient?
Queen.
Ayn Rand, the welfare queen? Ayn Rand, the moocher? Ayn Rand, the looter? That Ayn Rand?
Right. I was reading about her on her bio on Wikipedia, and I noticed when one of her books, something like For a New Philosopher or something like that, Gore Vidal called it almost perfect in its immorality. And they have some comments from other critics and also a list of the admirers. You know, I think there are elements of it that, you know, maybe people can, I don't know, or people kind of, this is an introduction of sorts to, like, philosophy. But, you know, that so many high school students don't get alternative, you know, heavy thinkers, you know. It's
right, and the thing with philosophy is, yeah. Philosophy's kind of like algebra as far as I'm concerned. You can't just jump into trig. You gotta start with the basics and build that knowledge base up and then get into the heavy stuff. And the same thing applies to philosophy. You can't anymore jump into Kant and Schopenhauer without having a background in Plato and Aristotle and the Greeks and Eastern philosophy. Then you can start out a first grader on the quadratic equation without teaching them how to count.
Well, speaking of Eastern philosophy, I was watching The Office last night, and they did an episode on a Hindu celebration. I think it's like Dishwar or something like that. And I know you only have a couple moments left here, but a beautiful, multicultural, humane presentation of another culture.
See, those liberal Hollywood elitists, they can be sneaky that way, Preston.
You know, just as the other side can be sneaky with their Ayn Rand stuff. And 400,000 copies of her books are shared for free to high schools each year. So, you know, we've got this, you know, kind of...
Yeah, where's
cool
the foundation
stuff
to provide 400,000 copies of Howard Zinn's of people's history of the United States to high schools. See, that's another example, Preston, of how our side don't get it.
That's true. Thankfully, though, we, through the grassroots, through word of mouth, through a few high school teachers assigning it, that Howard Zinn book has sold over 1.5 million copies.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt, but that's a far cry from 400,000 a year. I do have to get out of here, Preston, okay. But it's been a wonderful conversation.
Likewise, Bob. We'll talk again soon.
Take care. Bye now. And 2 minutes before the hour, time to get out. Hey, listen, we need 13 people. 13 people at $10 a piece, $130, and we are done fundraising for the month of January. A whole 4 days before January itself ends. Can you do it? Can we do it, please? I want to stop talking about this. I want to have two programs this month where I don't have to talk about fundraising. Wouldn't you like that? Wouldn't I like that? Remember, if you contribute $10, that's less than 5 cents an hour for the show. Let's do that. Thanks to everybody who makes all of this happen. First of all, you who contribute your ideas, your time, your energy, your thoughts, your chat in the chat room, your phone calls, your emails, and yes, your financial support. Thanks to Lottie in the chat room, our moderator there. Thanks to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan, our blogger, Texas Betsy. Thanks to my head writer, David in Tennessee, our op-ed columnist, Reverbo, and to Matt Osborne at Osborne, Inc., OSBORNEINK.com. Make that one of your first reads every morning. Might be a good idea. What am I thinking? Would be a good idea. Thanks to John Fox and Ben Birch, who apparently have a lot of the problems that bedeviled us last week licked. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ColeRiverWind.org. And always, 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 Gina, Judy, it's all for you.